We have the quorum present, and I'd like to convene the meeting, and we do have the minutes from April the 17th. Representative Atkins is nodding that he would like to move approval.
I've got several amendments, Mr. Chair.
To the minutes?
They look perfect to me.
Okay, motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Pawlowski's is the first bill that's up, but I do want to acknowledge Ms. Conley and Ms. Polkamp. They brought treats today in, and the reason that the treats are here is it happens to be my birthday. I want to thank them for acknowledging that. It's actually kind of become a tradition. I think last time it was in the retiring room. I'm not bashful about how old I am, by the way. This is number 73. So, some people that's sensitive, and I've just been up front. My youngest son will call me sometime today, and he'll say, old timer. That's the way he acknowledges my birthday. And then I tell him, well, the alternative is not so good, so I'll keep adding them, even though I'm the old timer in his eyes. He's a stand-up comic out in L.A., so that's why we start those kinds of conversations. But at any rate, thank you very much for acknowledging the birthday. Representative Pawlowski, we did have referred, as you know, the Senate file, and it was referred to committee this morning. So if you want to make the appropriate
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I would move that Senate file 1236 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register, and then I have a delete everything amendment, another motion to follow.
Okay.
Then I would move to delete everything after the enacting clause and insert the language of House File 1692. And I think we need to act on that motion to
That's
get the
right.
bill.
That motion is before us, and I think that the tradition is we like to support the House position as the bills are going through. So any discussion?
Because of the nexus to
Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Pawlowski.
Members, the Higher Education Finance Bill for this session will be the first time in almost a decade where we will be reinvesting in higher education. Both at the University of Minnesota and MinSCU, there will not be tuition increases at the undergraduate level as a result of the passage of this bill. We are going to reinvest 3% each year in both systems so students do not have to pay 3% each year and then borrow to pay it back over the course of a decade. We have seen over the course of the Great Recession some of the largest cuts, historic cuts to higher education in the nation and certainly in the state. We have seen the highest increases in tuition, and now we are seeing the result. Incredible debt, both at the University of Minnesota and in our 4- and 2-year institutions. We had a target of $150 million. We met the target. We did not exceed it. So this is where the money went. In the Office of Higher Education, we increased in the independent grant program approximately $10.9 million. And we would have liked to have done more, but as you're going to see, $150 million does not go far when we're trying to pay for tuition. In the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the undergraduate program, they asked for 3% each year. So tuition relief there is $7,800 million. University of Minnesota tuition relief is 42.6. In the University of Minnesota, this is only the second spot where we have what's called new spending. We have new spending in the grant program at $10.9 million, and we have new spending for the University of Minnesota. It is our only research institution in what they characterize as MinDrive, and that's $18 million. That's a third of what they asked for. That is also where you will see the only new complements in the higher education bill. Approximately 27 new complements will be there, and the research will be done in innovation, robotics, food supply, energy, and brain conditions. All of these are things that the university has excelled in the past, and we hope they can in the future. The other part of this bill deals with legislative oversight. You will see in the bill that working with the legislative auditor, we are going to change the way both systems report their budgets to the legislature. It is long overdue that the legislature reestablish oversight on how the tuition dollars have been spent that have been raised. I'm characterizing this now the same way we have legislative oversight on taxes. We should have the same level of legislative oversight on tuition. Tuition goes up, it tends not to go away, and its impacts now are decades in the future. So, members, the legislative oversight in this bill will say that they have to report to us biannually on the amount of money that they spend and raise and how it is spent and raised. We have conditions both at MNSCU and the U on certain areas. In one area, we end bonuses for the chancellor, vice chancellor, and all administrators in the MNSCU system in the future forward. I understand that the trustees took action on this yesterday, but just to parallel it, and you'll see documentation on the House floor of just how large these bonuses were and where they went. Mm-hmm. We also require that tuition not be increased above the 3% and 3% that we are supplying for the MNSCU system. At the University of Minnesota, the regents must take positive action on stabilizing tuition at 3% each year, or the Office of Management and Budget will not release the money. And that, more or less, is the bill. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, Chair Pawlowski, my strong congratulations to you and that you're coming to Ways and Means with a clean bill and not a bunch of amendments to change things here. And no, you're not adding any policy in Ways and Means. And I appreciate that due diligence on your part. And I just wanted to thank you for that. And if I might get a little more information, I'm sorry. So the state grant program, is it fully funded according
yes.
to need?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, we have done no cutting in the bill at all. We made one addition in the state grant program of $10.9 million in the independent student. There are no cuts to the bill. The numbers you see in the bill, other than the increases I just gave you, are all the same numbers we've had in past years.
Well, Mr. Chair, my recollection is that there was some computation that could be done based on projected enrollment and need, and so in that number that would come up on that calculation could be different than what was actually budgeted. So was that done this year, and at what degree of need?
Mr. Chair, the Office of Higher Education has the flexibility within its budget to meet it, and they told us they could do it within their budget to meet those calculations.
All right, thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Well, seeing none then.
Mr. Chair, I too want to echo Representative Holbert's congratulations to Chair Pawlowski for a good bill, but for other reasons, and one is for the major points that the Chair raised about getting our state back to investing in our public higher ed institutions. We're not alone, obviously, across the country. States will struggle with continuing to make those investments in higher education, and so this is an important move if we're going to have, a prosperous state in Minnesota going forward as we train and educate our young people. And obviously, I concur also with the moves to increase oversight of our institutions. You'll see elements of that later on in our K-12 bill as well. However, I would be remiss if I didn't spend a few seconds, Mr. Chair, just highlighting something that's missing from this bill. And I don't know if this session we're going to be able to get around to this issue or not, but at the very least, any opportunity to lift up the issue even briefly I think is important. And what's missing is a bill that I carried, which goes under a couple of names, the DREAM Act or the Prosperity Act, And Mr. Chair, this provision basically recognizes the fact that in Minnesota we invest in our K-12 system to do lots of things, including to educate the young immigrant children who reside in our nation without status. These are minors that were brought over as minors by adults and so had not made conscious decision to enter the nation without permission. Many of them actually did enter the nation under permission, but visas expired as our broken immigration system made it real clear to their parents that a 10 or 20-year wait in order to stabilize their presence wasn't going to happen. The point is, for here, it's not to really debate immigration issues at all, but it's really to acknowledge that we have young people who spend years in our K-12 system, who do everything that we ask all of our young scholars to do in K-12, including graduating from our high schools, achieving good GPAs, and aspiring to college and career goals, all for the sake of reinvesting those skills back into our society. And there is a bill that allows a way for us to honor that, move that forward, you know, for these students whose only desire is to become better educated and to invest their skills and knowledge back into society. The governor actually had a provision that didn't go as far as my bill, but recognized the importance of this really emerging public policy need for our society. And so Mr. Chair Plowski, you have a good bill here. I'm not going to say that you don't. I think it's important that we act positively on this bill. But, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to express my concern that we're not tackling this important public policy issue at this stage, and my hope is that at some time in the near future we'll be able to do that.
Great, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pawlowski. I was just curious. I'm guessing there's probably no FTE increases in this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I already mentioned that there were. I mentioned that in my opening statement. They were in only one area. That's the University of Minnesota. And the money that we put in, they asked for more. We gave them a third of what they requested. In the MnDrive program, there would be approximately 27. Those would deal with robotics, sensors, advanced manufacturing, securing the global food supply, advanced industry, conserving our environment, discoveries and treatments for brain conditions. Those would all be areas that the U has requested research dollars, and those would be the only new complements in the bill.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Pawlowski, are there any fee increases at all?
Fee increases are handled. We're trying to control them, actually, in this bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. Fee increases are handled by the trustees and the regents and also at the level of the administration. We're looking into fee issues. That will be one of our interim projects, along with a look at the election of regents and a number of other things. So as far as I know, in this bill, there are no fee increases.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Pawlowski, you know, one of my biggest issues has been the student service fees. Is that going to be part of your conversation this summer and fall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it will be. We have some categories, programs, where there are an inordinate number of fees. And some of these are parallel with K-12, particularly in the teaching programs. Those students are burdened with a number of fees, and the list just seems to get longer and longer. So we'll probably be working with Representative Marquardt on making sure that we can get those fees under control at the collegiate level.
Excellent. And last question, Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski. You know, I know in years past we've tried to put some restrictions on the University of Minnesota as far as tuition increases. I see that you've got that here as part of your bill. Will that stick, or do we run into any legality issues, or what have you been advised?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I've had four meetings with the legislative auditor on oversight. Even the legislative auditor has difficulty in crafting language to oversight the University of Minnesota. What this bill does is the best that we could come up with for now. However, we're not done with legislative oversight in higher ed. The time has got to stop when tuition can just be raised carte blanche by two systems that basically have political appointees and don't have any responsibility. What we're going to do today or this session in this body is raise probably a record amount of revenue. We're going to use that revenue to reinvest in education. Somehow those two systems, the trustees and the regents, have to be held accountable when they raise tuition. And if they don't want accountability, then we'll tell them what the tuition amounts will be, and that will be it, and they'll have to deal with it. And that's where I'd like to go.
Okay, Representative Steinman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pulaski, thanks for a good bill. I'm not on the higher ed committee, obviously, so this would be the only place short of the floor to discuss this. And without rehashing too much, I'd like to talk real briefly and ask your opinion, a focused question on the whole kind of Wall Street Journal line of articles. When I read that as a legislator and as a graduate of the University of Minnesota and as a supporter of the University of Minnesota, I thought that those disclosures made those of us who support higher ed and think we ought to do more investing look like idiots. And it made me extremely angry. I haven't had the occasion to sit in on any of the hearings in your committee, but I'm told they got that the University of Minnesota from you and others got quite a talking to, which I'm encouraged by. I understand, I've read all the op-eds and the counter-op-eds about what the explanations are for what is, I can only call, a incredible explosion of positions and administrative positions, while the regular Joe and Jane student are paying more and more and more and borrowing more and more and more. Without rehashing that, my one focus question for you is, as chairman, are you persuaded that the University of Minnesota has gotten the message? That's the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, no. When you have to spend $500,000 of new money to figure out how many administrators you have, you should already know that. You shouldn't have to spend a dime. The oversight language that you see here will cover administrative reporting, but I would like to, when we get into the next legislative session, craft a way that we even have to know if they increase administrators and where and how much. You'll see more information as we proceed here to the floor, even in the Minsky system, about administration there and salaries there and bonuses. While students are getting record increases in tuition and then subsequently having to carry record debt, we've seen administrators being paid exorbitant salaries and then bonuses on top of it for historic cuts, which I want to remind the committee, not one region, not one trustee came to this body and said these historic cuts were bad, that they had any negative influence on the students who would bear the burden of them for decades. Not one of them said that the tuition that they're raising has some type of a negative impact on the families or the individuals that have to pay for it. Well, now they're going to have to do it. And if they won't do it, then we're going to control it because it simply can't continue. So, Representative Simon, I'm not sure how to do it. This reporting language is a start, but by the time we're done, we're going to do it, and they're going to have to come and report. And the money that we're putting in now, it better not be spent on administration. It better be spent on students.
Okay, Representative Simon, is that it? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pulaski. Congratulations, it is a good bill. I kind of kept an eye on where you were going, and I'm appreciative of it. I'm looking on page 21, line 10, appropriations, friends, benefits. And what it says in here is, unless otherwise provided in law, direct appropriate, do not include, it may not be used for bonuses or for friends, benefits. What I'm trying to find out is, are you allowing the university to raise private dollars or from any of its other profit-making centers to use those dollars as bonuses and fringe benefits, and you're just, this language just is directed towards the direct appropriations that we as a legislator have control over?
These, Mr. Chair, Ms. Mahoney, this only is the money we would have control over. I know where you're going. And the athletic department, we don't have that much control over, but they do request buildings, and they want us to subsidize them. So there's going to be I've already spoken with Representative Hausman, a monitoring of when they come to us with an athletic facility, we may have found a new source of revenue to help us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I represent Plowski, and that really actually wasn't where I was going.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's where I was going.
It's always, Mr. Chair, it's always nice to understand where someone is going. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do that with Gene, with Representative Plowski on occasion. But there are fringes and other things done for their professors and for a variety of other things.
Yes.
The typical excuse is that other universities are doing this. And so I'm just wondering, is that an area where you'll be looking over the interim and next
year? Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we've heard the theory of market-driven ad nauseum in the Higher Ed Committee. There were five hearings on the current university budget in my committee, five on Minsky, and then two on their budget request for each system, 14 hearings altogether, just on budget. No bill was before us, just their budgets. We hear the argument of market-driven all the time, and I'm confused about what market they're comparing it to. Was it Wall Street? Was it banking? Was it real estate? Maybe it was the automotive market and the bonuses that they gave the people at the very highest, and then everybody else suffered the consequence of their decisions. That type of market-driven performance has got to stop, too. This is public service. You go into education because it is a public service. You don't go into it for the salary, and you certainly don't go into it for the bonus. So it's got to stop. You're serving the public. And if you don't want to serve the public, then go into the private sector and get more if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Mullery.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I thought it was Representative Anderson asked whether this would hold up. And having worked in the university attorney's office and written memos to the regents on what they could or could not do, I think this one does fall within the constitutional grounds. So I think this should stand up, at least under the memos I wrote.
Mr. Chair, I would recommend everyone work with the legislative auditor in crafting language. It's a very good experience.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Pulaski renews his motion that Senate File 1236, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
The next bill up is Representative Marquardt, and that's the omnibus education finance bill. And Representative Marquardt, if you want to put the bill properly before us.
I will. I'll move House File 630 be passed and be referred to the House Register, the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. We do have some amendments, but I don't think any of them are the author's amendments.
No.
So do you want to explain the bill and then we'll take amendments? I think might be a good way to go if that.
That would be great, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Before I start, I'd like to say also Representative Mariani is on this committee. He is the chair of the Ed Policy Committee, and in his very thoughtful approach put together an excellent policy bill. So if there's maybe some specifics, and I don't think maybe in ways and means on policy, Representative Mariani is here. Representative Reinert and Representative Dabney is also on the committee, and Republican lead Representative Woodard, who had just a great working relationship during the course of this session in putting this product together. Members, we had a target of $550 million. And as a committee, we wanted to make sure that this bill would make a difference. And so we set some very simple goals, but very powerful goals. And the major goal in this bill is to put our kids on the path to the world's best workforce. And we wanted to make sure that this bill would make a positive influence, a positive difference in the life of every single student in this state. The second thing we wanted to make sure we did is to move the needle on the dial in closing the achievement gap, making sure every kid graduates, making sure every kid gets to the adequate third grade literacy rate, making sure that every single student is career and college ready. And so what we have done here is we have set some very high goals. The goal is to get to the world's best workforce. And that means by 2027, we're looking at completely striving to completely close the achievement gap and make sure we have 100% graduation rates, literacy rates, and our kids who are career and college ready. Those are very ambitious, they're very powerful goals, and those are the goals of this bill. We then look at making sure that every dollar goes towards efforts and strategies that have a proven track record of increasing student performance and closing the achievement gap. And then we hold schools and their wonderful staffs accountable to reach those results. So you'll also see here that 97% to 98% of the dollars in this plan go directly into the classroom to hit those goals. And the other ones are related to get to those goals. So let me go over. There's five main parts as far as the funding source. $315 million goes to the formula, which is a 2% increase each of the next 2 years, which over 2 years raises the per pupil formula about $209. The second component on the funding is $102 if you net it out on, for the first time in the history of this state, fully funding all-day kindergarten, taking it to 1.0. Then there is $50 million that goes into early learning scholarships. That's the third part. The fourth part is an enhanced equity portion. It's about $30 million. And what that does, really, it takes school districts up to $300 on the operating referendum. And there's a lot of different reasons why districts, like 37, I believe, do not have any operating referendum at all, and about 54 are less than 300. There's many reasons. You know, property poor, they can't afford it, might be the political atmosphere there. But the bottom line is that the students are the ones who suffer. According to preliminary analysis, this will decrease the equity, decrease the widening of the equity by about 18%. And that was also one of the goals of the committee. It does bring the higher and lowers a little closer together. And the fifth main area of the bill happens to do with property tax relief, increasing the operating referendum equalization factors. And what we do is, brief little history, that's been frozen since like 1993, 1994, on the first $700 on an operating referendum, at about $476,000 of market value per kid. Well, back in those days, I think that's what a Dyna was. So it was one of the higher ones. And the way that works, just very quickly, is let's say you have a district that is $238,000 of market value per student. 238 is half of 476. So half would be your own levy, and half would be state aid. As you get wealthier, move up in market value per kid, it's more your own levy, less state aid. Well, what's happened is a lot of these districts might have got here at one time, and over those 20-some years have actually gone past, so it's totally levy, no aid at all. And so what we do is we take, instead of using a number, we take the average referendum and go up to 122%, which takes it to about $526,000. And then we index it into the future. So, which means that if the average market value per kid in the state goes up 5%, that number goes up. So that hopefully you won't go like this, you will ultimately kind of stay in the same proportion. That's really about 530 of the 550 in the plan. Those are the five biggest components. So, members, there are really no pilot programs in this plan, and there is only one specific school listed, and that's $85,000 levy for a Cyrus-Morris consolidation. So it isn't all these side pots. It's money going into where we can reach the world's best workforce. So that's kind of generally that. I haven't talked about the policy piece. There's some, it's what we have here is a systematic approach where we start early, where we know that the results are there, and then through a new assessment, we take it all the way through junior high, senior high, and then align that with career and college readiness. So you have a systematic, data-based approach going from early education, which we've never really invested there, all the way through aligning it with career and college readiness. And we believe by 2027, we can make a huge progress towards those goals and hopefully get to the world's best workforce. So, Mr. Chair, I would be open to questions.
Okay, and we'll take a few questions at this point, and then we'll go to the amendments. Representative Mariani.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I know we're not a policy committee, but I'll just very quickly identify the major policy provisions in the bill. We have a new student assessment approach in this bill that will replace the grad high stakes test, and that's work that Representative Reiner has led, resulting from a lot of deliberation over the last year from a task force of the Department of Ed. We do reinstate the integration revenue program. Members will recall that that was is slotted to be sunsetted, and so we do reinstate the revenue program. And then also add some reform to the implementation accountability around that program. We address an issue related to teacher licensing interstate in terms of the teacher candidates attempting to pass a basic skills test, and we're looking for a alternative high-quality assessment to that. There's good language here, housekeeping language around charter schools, basically dealing with conflict of interest issues with authorizers overseeing charter schools. Then we have a few other smaller policy provisions, including a tiny little but important Labor Day issue, which I suspect we'll talk about a little bit later. So, Mr. Chair, that's it.
I think that's on the list here. Okay, well, let's see. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just echo Chair Marquardt on the working relationship we've had between the Republican caucus and the Democrat caucus on this particular committee, and I really do appreciate that. But, of course, we do have some concerns. First and foremost is, can you kind of explain what's going on with House File 1, the payback of the shift, and in conjunction with that, what the amount is that we're going to pay as a result of not paying back the shift? Because I think it's $52 million in 14-15, if I'm correct on that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard. Now that the tax bill was approved out of tax committee, we know what's in the tax bill. Early on in the session, I said this was not going to be an either-or, that we could both pay back our obligation back to our students and schools fully, but also make major investments in education to move us to the world's best workforce, and that's exactly what we're doing. In the tax bill, not in this bill, but in the tax bill, there will not just be the payment shift paid back to schools, but also the property tax recognition shift. So totals about $850 million, and that's going to be paid back with a temporary surcharge on those who make over $500,000 income. So we'll pay back, not in this bill, but in the tax bill. We will have all the shifts paid back in the bills, in the tax bill.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. So the $52 million that we see in line 235, if the tax bill were to pass, would that $52 million go away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witter, I think I'll have Mr. Strom come up with that. Be okay, or Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Strom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I'm Tim Strom from House Research. The way the tax bill is carrying that, as I understand it, they're paying off both shifts in fiscal year 14. And essentially that means that they've got they'll be covering the cost in that amount in the tax bill that shows up on those lines on the spreadsheet. So that amount of shift savings that is built into the baseline budget disappears, and so the tax bill essentially carries that additional amount of state aid in their bill for that purpose.
Representative Whitaker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on the mandates issue, I know that Representative Dabney's bowling bill is not in this bill, but we did see a fiscal note, and I'm sure we'll talk about that shortly in this committee, of about $51, $52 million in local impact. And there's nothing in this bill that would pay for that, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, that's correct. I mean, the only possible area that would cover part of that impact would be the $5 increase on the Safe School levy. And that, as you know, Representative Woodard, we talked quite a bit about that. Unfortunately, we have, within the last couple years, placed some unfunded mandates in for schools. And the biggest one we have probably right now is the teacher evaluation system, which even at the time, back in 2011, according to an MMB, had over $60 million of costs. So the program went through. There was no money attached. So as you can see here, there really is no extra funding for teacher evaluation, which is another one we have hanging over our head at this point.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And, you know, I can certainly understand that. I know that we've also seen some numbers that show teacher evaluation would cost $285 million to implement, which I think we all agree is probably a little bit over the top. On the all-day kindergarten, we're talking about fully funding all-day kindergarten, and I know the number is 1.0. We talked a little bit in committee, and I want to follow up on why you chose 1.0 instead of 1.115, which is what we've normally done for full funding of all-day kindergarten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, you know, first of all, you're working within a target, but 1.0 is 1.0. That's fully funding. And what we've had in place since I forget what year is a little extra for grades 1, 2, and 3, and that's been the 1.115, which was for classroom reduction. And certainly with on the 2% and the 2%, that could be used for that also to apply. But you know, 1.0 is certainly fully funding that to the full formula amount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then continuing down this route on the mandates issue, I know that one of the key elements of the bill is reporting requirements from school districts. Did we ask for a fiscal note on that, on the local impact of the additional reporting requirements to MDE?
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, we don't. And there's already reporting that, I was looking through Chapter 120B, which deals with assessments and all the standards and that sort of thing. There's already reporting by school districts. But I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, one of the things that brings us all together, we could put $550 million into new funding and set all sorts of goals and walk away, feel really good, and wipe our hands. Or we can actually put a system in place that actually assures we're going to make progress towards those goals and actually make a difference. And the accountability that we have in this bill would require school districts to come up with a strategic plan for student achievement. But they actually have to write and make it public before a public hearing how they plan to use the dollars with the budget, how they'd use research-based data to get to the goals of the world's best workforce. Annually, they would have to come back at a public meeting, increasing transparency, talking, really focusing the achievement gap around the state, and have to talk about how they've what they've done in the last 3 years to move towards the goals, and adjust if need be, if the public would want that otherwise. They have to file this with the state. The state does not need to approve. These are local plans. But ultimately, and I think this may be coming, so I'll just talk about the accountability, is that we are moving, going with the governor's recommendation, to go from 3 centers of regional excellence to 9. And right now, these 3 centers of regional excellence, because that's not quite the excellence centers, right now they work with schools that are either priority or focus schools. Those are the schools that are not scoring as well or have larger achievement gaps. And they haven't been operating all that long, but what they have found out in the very short time, and these are teams that basically serve as coaches and work with schools on site to go in and use innovative research-based practices to help these schools. And what they have found out in the very short time they've used just these 3 around the state is that every single school where they've had a center in there has seen improved student outcome scores. And in fact, 15% of the 74 schools that right now are on priority or focus list, and they're supposed to be on there for 3 years, could get off in 1 year because of the gains they've already made. Much of it attributed to working with these regional centers of excellence. We would expand that to 9 to get to all corners of the state. And then if a school district isn't making progress towards these goals, there's no cut scores, there's no scarlet letters if they don't make it, as they move forward, if they don't, the MDE through these centers of excellence will work with school districts to help them through there in a coaching way. So I don't know if there's a lot of extra cost. I just think when we're putting $15.7 billion, about 40% of our budget, that we should expect some accountability. And if it costs a few bucks to go to the public, put together a plan on how you're going to use those dollars to get to the world's best workforce, I think it's well worth it. And let me just very quickly talk about something if we get to the world's best workforce. On February 19th, we held kind of a summit where we had people come in and talk about what would it look like if we get to the world's best workforce. And according to the governor's workforce group, that if we could get there, and if we could close the skills gap by 2018, 70%, we're going to need some post-secondary education, but we're way short of that right now. If we could close that skills gap, and they say closing the achievement gap's a big way to do it, you would lower the unemployment rate by 2% and be able to fill those 150,000 jobs. Rob Grunewald, who's with the Federal Reserve Bank, economist in Minneapolis, says that if we could close the achievement gap by 2027, in the next 15 years, it would make a difference of 1.8% on our gross domestic product. That's $5 billion a year. So, and you talk with Tom Stenson, who says, the economist, who says in the next 10, 15 years, our labor force growth, because of all the baby boomers retiring, is almost going to come to nothing. That the only way we're going to increase productivity is not by adding new numbers, but by closing the achievement gap and adding more productivity. It is crucial for the future of this state that we get to these goals. We might not hit everyone, but we've got to be moving towards them. And so I understand your question, Representative Woodard. I just think we have so much at stake here that if we don't have a good accountability system, I think this will work, is that we've got to have schools moving that way, and if they're not, they need to have the help to get there. I just think it's that important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the rest of my discussion I'll save for the floor.
Okay, we have Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is for Representative Mariani. In committee, we had testimony from a teacher. This has to do with the teacher licensure, who had taught now 5 years, I believe, with a provisional license and is going to end his teaching career at the end of the school year because he can't pass the test. I've had calls from others that are trying to pass the test and are within one subject area of, no, not quite making it. So what we wind up with here is a task force, so there is nothing we're doing this year to help those individuals, or can you point to some place that we are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, thank you for the question. And there was, in fact, a lot of concern about this expressed right off the bat at the beginning of the session, as you know. And we had bills introduced from both Republican and Democrats trying to address this issue. So obviously, everyone's recognizing that our current assessment system is to be polite, not ideal. What we're hearing directly, you know, from superintendents and principals, colleagues of these teacher candidates is, boy, you know, so-and-so is such a terrific instructor. Students are responding, you know, positively, really producing results, but for whatever reason, they're not able to get through this one basic skills test. We had a very, as you recall, very, at times emotional testimony from a art instructor, a young man from up north, who has a learning disability himself that makes it very difficult without accommodations for him to get through parts of the basic skills test. But nonetheless has produced, according to his superintendent, who drove down with him from up north, has produced terrific student outcomes for students. So what we did coming out of policy committee was, in fact, to pull together a task force to come up with a alternative but high-quality assessment system. There didn't seem to be, and I think appropriately so, you know, a lot of expectation that we not assess teachers as they're about to, you know, be conferred a license, but a growing awareness that this particular instrument that we're using right now, and since we began using it just a few years ago, you know, showing a huge uptick in initial failure rates, that there's something not quite right with this instrument. So that task force is going to come back with a better instrument for us to use. In the meantime, in regards to the individuals that you're concerned with, we did reinstate the ability for them to obtain those one-year waivers under the present system. So we're keeping the current assessment system in place because we didn't want to replace it, or we don't want to get rid of it without a replacement. But in the meantime, those teachers will be able to will still be expected to participate in that assessment, and then will be granted waivers for 1 year under certain conditions, including the condition that their district recommends that they, in fact, be waivered again for another year. And then some remedial help being offered for them to be able to prep for that test. So we do have an immediate short-term response for those individuals. And our hope is that next year we're going to come up with a better, high-quality instrument to be able to arrive at everyone's agreement that we should properly assess in a high-quality way our teacher candidates.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Arnes.
Representative Mariano, that's what I was looking for. I wasn't quite sure what the immediate temporary solution. Would that also apply to a recent graduate who has not been hired yet for his first teaching position? Would they also be able to receive a waiver?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, I believe the way it works is that they still need to take the test.
Yes.
If they're not able to get through the test, and if they are, if there's a district that's employing them, that wishes to employ them, then therefore they would be able to have the waivers to be employed in that district.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marcourt, comment on a couple of pieces on here. I like the epinephrine auto-injectors, allowing schools to have those in place. I think that's great. I did have a couple of questions, though, and the one I'll start with is you're requiring school districts who serve open-enrolled students and charter schools to cover 10% of the unreimbursed special education costs. Can you walk me through that a little bit, and can you tell me, have you done any financial runs in what that would mean for school districts across the state?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. First of all, I'll take your last question first. We're working on the runs on that. We don't have the numbers for sure. That is actually from the governor's recommendation and out of the task force report. And the rationale was for to have the serving district, I guess, have some skin in the game, so to speak. And so if they're covering 10% of the cost, the serving district, rather than the district that has the child paying all the costs, The rationale is there may be a little bit more cost containment if, in fact, the serving district has some skin in the game, too. So that's primarily the reason for that, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, I only ask because I know in the western suburbs and probably in other suburbs, too, we have a high number of school districts that have open enrollment students coming through. I know the Wayzata School District and Minnetonka and Hopkins, and those guys would be hit extremely hard by that, and I'll be interested to see the financial runs on that. The other question that I had, I guess you're going to be at some point talking about the early start date. There is now a good time to discuss.
What I was referencing, there is an amendment in your packet that deals with, erases that issue.
Okay, I'll pause on that then. And the only other thing that I wanted to ask you about, so you've got the reinstatement of the integration levy and putting those funds back in place. Are you still having the same formula that you're using for the distribution of those funds, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is a different formula. Representative Mariani really worked on that, and I guess if you want, Representative Mariani could really address that much better.
Mr. Chair, the formula essentially stays the same. However, we adjust the formula to accomplish a couple things. One is to make sure that there's some element of hold harmless so that districts that are currently accustomed to accessing those revenue programs are putting them to good use, you know, have mature programs, et cetera, that they're not facing this massive cliff in terms of loss of funds. However, the other thing that we're also looking for is, I guess kind of another way to put say it is, you know, some kind of equity. And so there is a redistribution that's happening here so that some districts who have not benefited in the way that many of us in common sense way thought they should be benefiting. The poster child of this would be Brooklyn Center, for instance, are able to access a greater revenue as a result. I could tell you in my school district alone, in St. Paul Public Schools, that redistribution element is going to cost that district around a little under $3 million, about $2.5 million. I think in Minneapolis around $3 million. So we have those tweaks in the formula itself. We also build in an accountability measure into the formula, and this is based on the integration revenue plan, where the districts are having to identify clear, measurable student outcomes, and then reporting those publicly using longitudinal data to measure those, and if they don't hit those outcomes, then the Department of Ed can then withhold, I think it was 5%, yeah, 5% revenue reduction for those districts. So that's also a change to the formulas as well.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, will you have runs on that too that compare what school districts used to receive to what the new formula is, so we can see a comparison between the old and the new formula?
Yeah, absolutely. We did have those throughout our committee process, so we can certainly make those available to all.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, even though not separated out on that, the integration revenue is included in the spreadsheet you have. Yes. Those are in there, even though they're not broken out, they are included on there, so you would see the...
And Mr. That. Chair and Representative Marquardt, I'm looking for by a school district, by school
yes,
district.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. And then just last, I just remember this as my standard question. Are you adding any FTEs to this? I can't imagine any fees, but... and. Yeah. That's my standard question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm supposed to be the teacher normally, but I've heard this homework assignment because I've been in class a few other times, so I did come prepared, Representative Anderson. What we have here, it looks like right now it's about an increase of FTEs of about 18, two for the Climate Center that's in the bill, three for the Office of Early Learning, 10.5, for the additional regional centers, and an additional two for the lending library and activities director. So it's roughly 18. That could vary yet a little bit, but that's roughly the number. And as far as fees, there are no fees in the bill, but I do have to mention this, is that now with the all-day, everyday kindergarten, there's currently about 10,000 kindergartners that are in a fee-based kindergarten program. And so we were able to find out what that costs that parents were paying, and right now parents are paying about $26 million in fees for kindergarten, which now with the all-day kindergarten, those fees would disappear. So for folks around the state who currently are in fee-based, there'd be about a $26 million savings for those parents.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Marker, if you'd be willing to send me the FTE report, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know if this is, we'll try, yes, we can do that. I kind of got a cheat sheet here in front of me, so.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I need this now. I hope you had a good time, and your first time was doing all this was a lot of work. I know, I remember that feeling. I have a couple of comments and maybe a question or two. I asked Mr. Strom about the statewide average per district, as you were mentioning. It seems like it's 130 the first year and 450 450 the second year was his estimate, which I would presume if you had a question, you'd ask him. So I just went right to the horse, Mr. Representative Marquardt. This is a really hard project. I miss being involved in it more directly than I am now, just because you get shifted out of different areas. But there's a phenomenon that occurs, and it's something to do with the North Metro. And the kids in the North Metro actually are cheaper to educate, turns out, historically, because they keep giving us less money as a habit. And you probably don't realize this, but in the bill, it actually perpetuates. Get the wrong section here. And so I just have some advice for you as you analyze your own bill going into conference. If you look at the statewide average number and look at what districts are beneath the average, some are easy to understand why they're above the average because they didn't have a levy, and some of those districts are getting $300-$400 a year per pupil, which is, and I don't mind that they get it. Some of those are in small districts and they need a levy because their funding has been challenged. But I just want to point out to you the names of some school districts that are below the average in the first year of your bill, and in generally the second year too. Monticello, Becker, Big Lake, Elk River, Princeton, St. Francis, Anoka, Forest Lake, and Braham. And I know what kind of person you are, I know your intent, but these have been habitually below. And I'll make a case in point about Elk River. If you want to visit some average district in the state and then go visit Elk River, you go like, how come they don't have some of this stuff? They have a sixth period day. They have a science class meeting in a lab closet. They're in the worst of all situations. They're a growing district, and at least in the southern half has money, the northern half doesn't. And they're in your proposal here, they're not even getting the average again. And they have some proposals that are unique in their problems. But there's many districts that are in similar circumstances. I know as a chair, you heard about how many of the 440 districts or something, and they all wish they could do something. But I'm just pointing out to you that as a category, and there may be other pockets across the state, I don't know what the South looks like. I think the Southwest usually has done pretty well because they can levy themselves. But Anoka tries hard to, and I appreciate equalization, that increase in the formula, the indexing. I've been trying to get that since I was a freshman, so thank you for working on that, and that'll at least help make it easier so we can tax ourselves, so we can take care of our essentials. But Elk River is in a challenging spot as a singular school district, and I don't think it's fair that because a kid is born and lives in a certain part of the state that they get a lousy education to where they just happen to get born in some other part of the state and they do great. And I know that burdens you, and I appreciate your discussions in your rhetoric about what you're trying to do, but I want you, as you look at this and as you go into conference, look again, just for your own interest, take the average and look at who's below average in their first year. See how it winds up in a disparity. And it'll just affect your view. And you go like, wow, I didn't realize we were doing that. And you don't have to comment. An observation for you.
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, you get right to the heart of things here. And you know, some people, they want to look at things and they just want to blow up the whole formula and start all over again. And We, of course, didn't do that. There's really hardly any formula changes. And, you know, when you look at a system, just like kind of look at local government aid or in the property tax stuff, all those things are in there for a reason, to try to make things fair. Because, for example, some of the districts you mentioned that are less than the average probably have less kids on free and reduced meals. And that would be the compensatory dollars. And we linked everything. So if you, when we increased the formula 2%, 2%, we kept everything linked the way it is. We kept the compensatory linked, we kept the sparsity revenue linked, all those things linked. So if you happen to have more kids on free and reduced, you know, you'll get that versus not. There are really two different areas in the bill that tend to favor one part of the state over the other. Otherwise, you know, the two and two, $315 million, that just goes out in the formula. The $102 million, that's all-day K, that'll, I guess, benefit school districts that have more kindergartners, but otherwise, no regional thing. The early learning scholarship, you know, that's not even on here because that's... So there's two parts in there. There's the enhanced equity that raised everyone up to $300 on the referendum. That goes almost entirely out to rural Minnesota. That's about $30 million. That's almost entirely to rural Minnesota. On the other side, though, the other different revenue source is in an integration aid, and that's $28 million, almost the same amount. That goes disproportionately to the metro area. And if you, so you really, you know, you have that mix, and, you know, if you look at the numbers, and I would have you look at this, because, you know, we want to make this as fair as possible. If you look at the last two columns, and if you actually look at the metro total and non-metro, you notice they're almost the same on increase per student, 489 and 487. The percentage in rural Minnesota is greater because it's starting from a little lower base, and so you get higher. And that's another thing you have to look out for when you look at the percentages, is the dollar amount might be the same with another district, but the percent might be lower because it's starting with a higher base and the number's a lower percentage going off of that. But there were some goals we had here, first of all, making sure we closed the achievement gap, but one of the goals was equity. And I think according to kind of the preliminary numbers we have, that the equity is going to decrease. The gap in the equity is right now about 31%. And back 10 years ago, it was like 18%. So it's really gone. We think we moved that back, probably cut the difference by about 15% or so. I mean, it's not great, but we do bring that up. So you hit it right on the head. I mean, it's tough. You know, the formulas are what they are. I think the formulas have a lot of basis to them. You know, the free and reduced, there's correlation that poverty equates into the achievement gap. There's huge correlation there. And so I think we should be putting dollars in those areas where we think we have the best impact to close the achievement gap. So, you're exactly, it wasn't easy. It was trying to do all sorts of things, but like I said, there's no pilot programs, hardly anything, so there's no side pots to really mess up how things go. It's just those two main areas, really, integration aid and equity revenue are the two big spending things that kind of go in different directions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you can tell I really miss being on the committee, so you have to make up for it here. So, but I think these are worthy discussions. Maybe it'd be fun to see a spreadsheet that went against the 2013 base, and then all the new money that goes to a district, including base increases. Because, Mr. Chair, I was wrong. It was 759, not 795. And it came out of the November forecast. And I can show you the page. And it was independent of the shift. The base funding increase for human services was 743. The base funding increase just by the formulas and forecast was 759 for this biennium. That was November's number. I don't know if it changed in the February forecast. But it'd be interesting to see if you take out the 759, look at the 2012 and 13, and then add in the 759, and then your 550. Then how the money goes, that would be another interesting thing. That's how much more money East District is getting based upon what's been there from before. And frankly, linking these formulas is a disadvantage to the ones who don't get the benefit of concentrations. And that's the continual challenge. But these kids have the same challenges, whether they're concentrated or whether they're separately. And these Elk Rivers and Anokas and, you know, Osseos don't have the density. Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, do you have a tails target? Were you given a tails target in this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I do. It was about $991 million.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to understand, we had a target in our committee. Do you know what our target was, Representative Marquardt, in the Human Service Committee? Minus 150 in the tails. Just to tell you. That was just kind of shocking to me. I still am struggling with that. And so my frustration is several. I'm happy to work hard in my area and help Chair Huntley and the people on that side, a million people, you know, with various challenges. We've got a million students or 800,000 or whatever. When some of these same disproportionalities or whatever, asymmetries go forward, and the same schools that always got the same little, got the same screwed over percentages under Senator Pogemiller, continue now. Anoka was happy to be in the second quartile. That would be success. We never even got above half on stuff. And I follow them the most, but many districts, especially in the north side and these other pockets, you know, have traditionally not gotten their share. And those kids aren't any better off. And I think we have a duty here. I'm just challenging you as a new chair, and I'm challenging you more than some because I know you're interested in this. I'm not sure we're doing as well as we think we could do with $1.2 billion in new money to the education net. This is not pocket change. And I don't diminish the value of any St. Paul or Minneapolis student, what they need and the challenges of mobility and all that. I understand it all. I'm sympathetic. I help them on the human service side to have housing and stability so they can have a chance to succeed and be all they can possibly be. But we have a duty statewide. And I just wanted to remind you about that. And I didn't realize until I got here your target was close to $1 billion. And so I'm not running the place. But I care about what goes on in the whole state. We all have a duty in this table, in this room, to the total needs of the people we've decided to serve. We do have a constitutional duty to K-12. There's no constitutional duty to the human service side and to the needs that those people represent. That's a cultural, societal need, that choice that we have made to look after these individuals in certain ways. I just have one more question, then I'll stop, just kind of on that topic. I signed a bill with Representative Winkler to see if there's some way we could help some of these kids get chances to eat their lunches. I don't remember the number anymore. Can't find the bill. You know what that one was, Representative?
Can you just tell us, Representative, what it was doing?
Well, it was subsidized to some of the free reduced kids. I was just curious if that was included in the bill or not. Oh. No, I can't find it.
Representative Marquardt?
You know what I'm talking
Mr.
about?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do. Representative Abler.
Oh, here it is, right here.
When I don't think, what we did with school lunches is added 1 penny from 12 cents to 13 cents at a cost of $2 million over the biennial.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one more question. What was the, I remember that the lunch people came in and they brought very small apples because they're so frugal. They didn't bring the big ones. They had the little ones that are the, you know, you get 200 in a box or something. But what was their request? Do you remember?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I can barely remember what's in the bill, much less what's not in the bill right now. But
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not trying to be too rough. I'm just trying to challenge us as a legislature. You know, you've chosen to raise $2.6 billion, and bless you for that. You ran on it. You're doing what you said. But Elk River still is going to be unable to teach us kids in the most average of ways. Anoka has had longer, and they're a little bigger, and they have some economies of scale, those little tiny pockets of, you know, money, and thanks for keeping that. But there's a lot of districts like that in my neck of the woods and across the state that are going to be fully challenged, even in the face of $1.2 billion more spending. So I'll stop. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, comment, Representative Abler, and I'll share this with you. You had left yesterday, but I asked Mr. Marks to calculate the base growth. And there are two different numbers, as I shared with the committee, that you can use with K-12. One including the shift payments and one excluding. And the numbers are dramatically different when you compare them. So I'll show you those on the House floor. I happen to have it on my desk after Mr. Marks did it. I don't want to ask him to do it again here today, but sometimes you have to be a little careful when you're comparing across jurisdictions in terms of what those numbers are, especially when you had large payments to shift and different bases for the growth. And without debating that, I'll just give you those numbers on the House floor.
The numbers you shared are right, but there's another number that you could use as well that includes the shift payments, and that's different than the number you shared. So, Representative Markwart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and first of all, we took very seriously the target we received. And the fact is, I mean, we're going to use the dollars we have, and I think I've spelled this out, to make a real difference in not only every student, but also to make sure we increase value to our communities and get to an economy into the future that is going to pay back dividends many, many times over. And that's why, you know, you've got the accountability piece in that besides putting dollars in areas that we know. But I would disagree with, and I don't think you're saying this, Representative Abler, as far as Elk River, but I'm willing to bet they would say they're providing. I know the superintendent. I've known him since he was in Hawley and Fergus Falls in my area. And he was before our committee. And I would argue they're providing an excellent education in Elk River. Excellent education. And this bill over the 2 years will provide $6.5 million of new dollars for him to continue to do that in his school district. Representative Abler mentions the $700 of new dollars, like it's just new dollars to spend. Those are dollars on the base. And one thing you have to remember that is not in on this is that there are two inflators on the education finance budget. Sure. And one is special education.
Excuse me.
Representative Markwart keeps referring to a document that wasn't distributed to the committee.
Do they have this?
Yeah.
This?
I guess not.
Oh, okay. No. Okay. We will... No. That's the runs. I know the committee, the education committee had that, but it's runs for each district. I'm sorry. I apologize.
You probably have that available on the House floor at this point.
We can. Yeah. And I know the education committee all has that. So sorry about that, Representative Holberg. It is also posted on the website for, at the education committee, finance committee. So you can find that there. But that will kind of give you the dollars of what you're receiving new. But a lot of this kind of in the base. One of the areas where you actually have an increase is in special education funding. Now, we've got a huge cross-subsidy. I mean, the costs are over $600 million more than what dollars are getting. But there is a 4.6% increase, which means this year school districts get $50 million more dollars for special ed, and the next year will be $53. That's not on here. So that's part of those dollars when you talk about the $700. Another thing is more free and reduced students. That goes into the base. More students, that goes into the base. Part that's also included is in the last session, some of the items like small school revenue and that new literacy incentive aid, that was funded for in the second year of the biennium, which means this time around we get both years of the biennium, which ups it. So the $700 isn't just new money. This is in the base, and it's not quite as clear as I think Representative Abler makes that. But you know, these are all decisions that we have to make. And I think when you look at the $550 million of new dollars being spent here, not only is every dollar going to get to the world's best workforce, but we then also apply the accountability system to all $15.7 billion in that program. Or that goes to education.
Okay, we've got three people, I think, that have identified themselves as part of this discussion, and then I think we'll move to amendments. So I have Representative Loon, Holberg, and Reinhart. So, and at that point, I think we'll go to amendments, if that's all right with the committee. As soon as we're done, they'll reconvene the House, so we do want to expedite some things to some So, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two different questions. So the first I'll ask Representative or Chair Mark Wright. The Principals Academy, funding for that, do you know how many approximately will be able to take advantage of that with the funding available?
Mark Morton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I need help on that one. The staff will be looking.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And we'll get back to you.
We'll revert
possible.
Back then and get a follow up.
No, but I want a question on a separate topic, and it's probably more in the policy area. So if you want to defer to Representative Mariani, your choice. But
I would.
The math test, and I similar to Representative Abler, I'm not on an education committee this year and have had severe withdrawal all session because of it, but you know, the math test has been a big topic of conversation here for a number of years, and you know, I had expressed when I was in committee concerns about the current test, but we've kind of gone to looking at alternative tests or measurements, which I think is a good idea, but no real cut score or a situation where we've actually are having an ultimate determination of a level of proficiency for students that we want them to achieve. So I guess I'm just wondering if that, I'm assuming I'm understanding that correctly, but could you fill me in on some of the discussion? Is there anything in the bill, I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing yet, that may be coming down the line?
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, and I miss not sitting next to you in the K-12 committees. I think we did some very good work over the last 4 years or so, and have always enjoyed your ideas and working with you on K-12 education. The math grad test, which is currently frozen, will be unfrozen unless we act this year, I believe, next year, was a test that several years ago really kind of pointed, was the initial indicator that we may be using the wrong kind of assessment for student achievement here. I was here when we started the grad test several years ago, and quite frankly, at that point, the grad test was sold to us not so much as an argument about enhancing student achievement. And quite frankly, there's very little literature across the nation that ties the use of high-stakes testing to driving student achievement up. There are lots of literature on other things that can do that, including the assessment system that we're replacing the grad test with here. But at that time, several years ago, maybe 7 years ago, the grad test was sold to us as a necessary thing to do in order to make sure that students took the test seriously enough, because we were using those tests to ascertain the effectiveness of schools. In other words, determining their AYP status under the original NCLB framework. And what we realized several years later is that we created a high-stakes consequence for students that had nothing to do with students. It just had to do with schools wanting to make sure that they had the best possible results on the MCAs so that they would not get punished with AYP consequences. I think it's appropriate to have an assessment system that can be used to hold our schools accountable. That's not changing. We still have the MCAs. It's now being used under the waivered NCLB program. But I do think that it's appropriate for us to come up with an assessment system that actually advances students relative to something meaningful out in the real world, and that meaningfulness is really tied to college and career readiness standards. So it isn't just the math test, then. It's there's three grad tests that are currently being administered that will be replaced, so to speak, by this new student assessment system. And Representative Bider can certainly fill in more about the logic and how that works. But yeah, if this legislation is successful, we will not be using the grad high stakes test any longer in this state.
Thank you. Were you able to get the answer to the first question, Representative Markhorn?
I was. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, it'd be 25 to 30 participants kind of per class, and then they are expected to go back and also teach other principals in their district.
Well, thank you, and just, you know, a quick comment, and I know we have a lot of business to do, but I stay pretty close to my schools and have had a chance to visit with some principals, and, you know, I think from what I've observed even in my own district, that, you know, the principal at the helm of those schools makes all the difference in the world on, you know, how those schools are doing in terms of reducing their own achievement gap within that building and mentoring their teachers, and I don't think I had a full appreciation of that until some recent visits I did. So I think if that academy is going to help produce the kind of principals that I met with recently, I think it will do a world of good for our system. And I thank Representative Mariani for his response. I'm kind of firmly of two minds on this particular issue, I must confess. I don't like the current grad tests that we have for math, but I do think we need to have some measurement that we are graduating students with a certain level of proficiency in the basics that they're going to need, and math is one of those things. So I look forward to continuing to work with you on that. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this I'm going to just divert very briefly to a policy issue, and my understanding is that the data provisions that were on page 155 of this bill went through the Civil Law Committee as a part of an early learning scholarship program. I must have been absent that day. But if you look at the language on lines 13 through 15, collection and use of data to the extent available, meaning if it's there in the record, the director may collect data from participating programs on recipients, and then you also have including but not limited to, so wide open, information on demographic, socioeconomic participation and assessment data. Once again, there is no privacy protection here whatsoever, and I guess I was sitting here thinking about when Representative Ellison was still here, and he was a strong supporter of that. Just because you were taking public dollars or getting help for programs, that government shouldn't have access to all kinds of information about you. And there are no constraints at all in that language. And somebody should take a look and delineate specific data sets for specific purposes. And if you look at the federal standards around disclosing some of this type of information, you actually have to have parental permission for disclosure. And so there is a lot of room for improvement in this provision in this bill.
Representative Markhorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Oberg, and yesterday I sent you this part of the law for you to look that over. And we certainly, yeah, Representative Winkler carried the bill and did go through civil law, but we certainly can work on this and see if we can tighten that up. I'd be certainly agreeable to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is probably the loosest language I've ever seen when you think about the information that a child care or a provider has on the family dynamics and workings of young people, and the thought that government could, with to the extent that it's available and not limited to anything, ask for information, I think that that's going a little too far.
On that point, Representative Mahoney.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hoberg, Subdivision 11 talks about collecting data on the scholarship students, and then paragraph B explicitly says data on scholarship applicants and recipients are private data on individuals as defined. That's pretty, if I remember, and it's been, thank God it's been a long time since I've been on civil law, at least a year, if I remember right, private data is as high as restricted as you can get. Is that not correct?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, to the degree that the press could go in and look at it or somebody else, but it doesn't. The government would have it. Is it the government's business to collect with no? I mean, they can choose whatever they want, and they get it if the provider has it on a family or individual child. And once they have it, it's private. But they can get whatever they want. So you have to ask yourself, do you want whoever's running this program to have unfettered access to the whole range of information that child care providers have on their kids and their family? Once they get it, yeah, it's private, but they can still get it.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
You know, I've actually, one of the things I'm going to be looking at in the next year is the number of reports and the types of information that we ask on job providers and job trainers and job trainees. And it's stunning how much we want to know so that we can do policy. So as you are looking at fixing this or changing this, be aware that the information that you're gathering here is what we use to develop policy. So, you know, be careful what you say you can't use, because otherwise we don't have the opportunity to make reasons and thoughtful decisions on our policy as we move forward. I'm not arguing, because I'd probably be arguing with both hands tied behind my back, and you beat me over the head with your ability to on data privacy, but it is a slippery slope when we start closing doors and then we don't get to make good policy.
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, 151.20 and 21 might address that too. It talks about early learning scholarships and governing data. And Representative Hoberg, you probably would have received that part yesterday when I sent this out. But, you know, if there's concerns, Mr. Chair, we can work on this.
Okay, why don't you take a look at that? I think on this point, Representative Mullery, and then I want to recognize Representative Reinhart for the last question before we go to amendments.
I didn't want to ask a question, Mr. Chair. I want to make a point, because I work a lot with the Institute on Child Development and the whole youth development, the education and family over it, and we have one of the leading institutions in the country on this research, and they are complaining to me all of the time about problems with this state trying to get the data, so that if you don't have the data, you can't figure out what is working and what isn't on children as they're growing up. And so the more you restrict that data from research, the more you are harming our better development of children.
Okay, Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief, but I think Representative Hoberg does have a point. I think that I carried an amendment in the when we were putting together the omnibus bill the other day on this data issue that came out of House research, and we were trying to tighten up that language. So we're certainly open to further discussion on that. I think that the Many Minds group that put together some of this language, it's simply an area that hasn't had the experience of having asked some of these questions. And I think we'd be happy to have you be involved in helping us do a better job of addressing the data concerns. Representative Loon, again, I don't want to totally get into the whole perspective about the issue of proficiency and basic skill scores, but it is a fundamental philosophical concept, and what we're doing in terms of the high school redesign program and the partnership between MNSCU and our secondary system, and part of it is to be much more flexible about what benchmarks are and how they relate to a student's future goals and skills and abilities, so that what is a minimum competency in one career area might be quite different from what a minimum competency is in another, and that we don't have students that spend 3 years chasing that line in the sand and then drop off our radar totally in high school, and we've given them no direction or promise for the future or ability to be contributing citizens. So that's part of the discussion around the cut score issue, and there's a lot of literature about it. But anyway, that issue. And then Representative Abler has left, but his discussion about particular school districts and how they're faring under this bill as a whole is a complex discussion that we won't fix in one budget year. There's still districts that are going to be cutting their budgets. And part of it goes back to 2003 under Governor Ventura, when we shifted off the local levies and the state never figured out how to fund that cost. And we haven't. If Representative Greiling were here, she'd do a much better, former Representative Greiling, of speaking to the 10 years that was put in by PS Minnesota to try to balance the formula and figure out how to address issues of equity across the state. And there was a proposal on the table in the form of Minnesota Miracle 2, but it took funding, and at that point we had no funding to put on the table. So I think we do have that challenge, but I don't think we're ignorant of it.
Okay, I think we'll go to amendments, and I think we'll leave the privacy question then. Representative Marquardt indicated he would be willing to take a look at that language. I see Representative Holbert is left, but I suspect that there will be a continuing discussion on that. The first amendment we have is the A54 amendment, Representative Dittmer.
Okay, sorry.
And I understand you have an oral amendment that...
yes, Mr. Chair.
...to put it in the order that you'd like.
The A54 amendment originally was House File 957. But if you look on line 1.10, after the word the first the, insert 2014 school year. Just 2014. I met with the PCA prior to the meeting, and they would like to have a little more time with this. And then on line 1.18, the word paragraphs, just delete the S on paragraphs. And then the letter B. And then change do to does. And that's my changes, my oral.
I was a little confused on that line 1.10. I thought you said after the first the.
1.1, let's see, excuse me. 1.10, the beginning of the school, between the school year, just insert 2014.
Okay, so it's after, before thus. It's the second thought, then, that you want, right?
Beginning of the 2014 school year. At the school. So the first thought.
The first thought.
The second? Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, there's the one at the beginning. Yeah.
The second thought.
Yeah.
So
okay.
So everybody.
Got you.
And you can just incorporate that into your amendment if everybody has it. Okay, if you want to explain the amendment then, or Representative Dittmer moves the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think most of you know that I spent 34 years as an educator, as a teacher. And I know every year our school district would always put out a report on type of chemicals we're using in the school for cleaning and also asbestos elimination. And what this bill does basically will require a school district to put out, inform the parents if their facilities are next to a landfill. And this could be done on their website, or could be done through general mail. This is a bipartisan piece of legislation that passed the Representative Mariani's policy education committee. And so it just would be required of the school districts to inform the parents. I think we all want good environments for our schools, for our children, and for our employees, for the teachers and the staff. And I really would like to see this really take forward in this in the policy part of the policy of this of the finance bill, and that we carry this forward.
Okay, Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Detmer, I certainly understand what you're doing here, and I did hear the bill when it came through the policy committee. I think it was referred to the environmental committee, I believe, and I don't know if it ever got a hearing there. But I, members, I think there's just so many questions as to cost for notification. You know, what's it going to cost for an environmental consultant and study? It just, it has not been vetted enough in my view, and so members, I'd ask at this time to oppose the amendment.
Can I, just to share with the committee, of course, Chair Dill is not on this committee, but he did communicate that he would like to, he's asking, I think he's had a conversation with you, Representative Detmer.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
That he would like to hold on the amendment and that he made a commitment that he would have a hearing on the issue at some point. I don't know if he's talking this session or the interim or next session, but that he would have a, right, I guess he said it's next year, that he would have a hearing next year on this particular issue. I just want to share that with me. That's the desire of, did you say that's the committee, Representative Marquardt, that has possession of the bill now, or maybe you know Representative Detmer?
Well, Mr. Chair, I did talk to Representative Dill, and he said that would probably the one, be one of the first bills that he would hear next year. But I really feel that this is something we can do now in this in this piece of legislation. You know, right now there's currently five school districts that this would apply to, and then there's I think a total of 11 buildings that are close to a landfill site. And the main emphasis is just to communicate that with the parents. I mean, we have information going out all the time from our school districts about, you know, what's going on in the school, and this is just a communication with the parents and for the safety and the health of our children. I think one parent made a comment to me, and then I'll just share that with the committee. It says what we didn't know yesterday about our landfills that we have. Today we do. And what we don't know today about our landfills that we have, tomorrow we will. And I don't know if we want to take that risk. If there are schools that want to build new facilities, if you look at the first part, subdivision 1A, just that after 2013, no school will be constructed within a quarter mile of a dump site or closed landfill. And part B, just are telling the school districts to inform the parents if they are built next to a landfill. So I would garnish the support of the committee members here, and then we go forward with this.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, obviously the members will decide for themselves, but I do want to share that our policy committee did, in fact, hear this bill and did act positively toward recommending it to pass. And then, but then we did move it on to, I think maybe it was Environment Committee, and since then I think it might have been moved on to another committee as well. And I think part of that it was because from our committee, we spoke to the education issues of the committee, and we felt that this was an appropriate education policy, initiative. We then left it to the other committees that have much more knowledge about environmental issues to then weigh in. So again, obviously we'll leave it to the members, but I guess I'm just sort of speaking on behalf of my committee, policy committee, that did affirm Representative Detmer's bill.
What I was doing was sharing, it must be an impression of Representative Bill's committee, because he's made the commitment that he would hear at the beginning of next session That's what he communicated to me and asked me to share with the committee. And he did have conversations with Representative Dittmer, but the amendment is before us, so further discussion.
And Mr. Chair, spending all those years in the classroom and knowing the importance of not only safety but have a healthy environment for our kids, I really feel strong about this. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been brought it. I know talking to Representative Marquardt, he doesn't want to put any amendments on his bill. I appreciate what you're doing for education. You're an educator also, like myself. But I really feel we need to really take a close look at what we know about landfills right now. I think PCA, meeting with them, I did make some changes. If you look in the last part of the bill, they asked that I also put down some clarification in terms of what a dump site is and what a closed landfill is, and regarding school buildings. That was all language that was added after I met with other people. So I think I've done my job making sure that we have a piece of legislation that I think the people of Minnesota would be happy with. I know it's a bit controversial, but I feel it's very important that we pass this on. It would go to a conference committee, I'm sure, and things can be done there if we need to make some changes. But Mr. Chair, I'm committed to this, and I would like a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question to the author, to Representative Dittmer, or if anybody else wants to chime in. Just a question. I mean, are there no requirements now? All the process that's outlined in your amendment, does none of this occur currently when a school building is being cited?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I know when a new piece of a district is going to build a new building and so forth, they have a process they have to go through, and but what we're learning about landfills and the environment and some of these hazardous wastes that we might find in some of these landfills, we're learning new things all the time, and what schools did years ago versus what schools are doing today, things have changed. But all we're doing here is requesting that schools inform the public, and that's the main emphasis of my legislation.
And let's see, Representative Dabney. You would recognize Representative Dabney. We'll give you a chance to get to your seat.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I thought I'd actually try to get some facts under me before I started talking. Representative Dittmer, I guess I'll put it in the form of a question. Why do you only apply this to traditional public schools? Why do you not apply this equally to charter schools?
Representative
Dittmer. Well, charter schools are public schools.
No, they're not.
Charter schools are public schools.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, you're correct, but... Yeah. Your amendment doesn't apply to charter schools, so I'm trying to understand why you would apply it to traditional public schools but not to charter public schools.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative, I just, in my putting the legislation together, I just felt that a public school is a public school, whether it's charter or a traditional public school.
Well,
maybe
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, I can share the value there, but that's not reflected in the amendment. Your amendment applies to, for instance, schools operated by the Minneapolis Public Schools, but does not apply to charter schools in the city of Minneapolis. Ditto St. Paul, Elk River, Maplewood, Duluth, and so on. It only applies to the traditional schools.
Mr. Chair, and like I said, we're going to have a conference committee, and if that's some of the changes that needs to be done, we can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for raising that. The So under Minnesota law, you have to explicitly state the charter school being inclusive in our policy directions, and so we don't have that here. You know, Representative Debmer, I support your bill and your concept. I spent quite a bit of time with your constituents, who I think have done pretty courageous work over the years of, you know, pointing out something that should not have happened, that happened up their way, and their interest really is to make sure that it doesn't happen anywhere else in the state, because what's happened there has happened there. I do think, however, that, you know, given the fact that Representative Dill has now not only spoken to you, but actually spoken to our Ways and Means Chair, and committed himself to giving a hearing on this issue, that, you know, given that there may be other issues here that clearly our education committee did not have the expertise to address, that you might be better off just pulling this amendment back at this point. I don't think you want a negative vote out of Ways and Means here. I don't know. Well, that would be my counsel, and I do support your effort here. We do have a hesitancy on the part of our finance chair, and I totally want to respect our finance chair's desire to have his bill look the way it was prepared coming up to this point. I think you have good public policy here, but perhaps right now is the time to try to force this issue.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Marani. And as I mentioned before, that I feel real strong about this, and if you've spent some time in schools, which some of you have, and the importance that we're doing here, I really feel that we need to take a real close look at what we're doing here. As you know, I know this is the last committee stop for this. It can go to a conference committee, and I think you all have to ask yourself, when you feel strong about something and you feel it's important that you do it, that you go forward with it. Like all of us, we get up in the morning, look at ourselves in the mirror, and you say, have you done the right thing? Have you done the right thing for the people that you represent? And we all represent students. There's 29 other states that do have legislation on the books regarding this. Minnesota doesn't. And I want to go forward with this.
Hey, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Representative Mariani. And one of the reasons is, you know, as a strong environmentalist, I think there's all sorts of other issues that ought to be addressed in your amendment that aren't. You know, in Minneapolis, for example, we have a garbage incinerator in the vicinity of a number of schools that's spewing all sorts of toxins into the air. So you don't have those types of facilities. We also have, you know, a lot of industrial facilities in our urban neighborhoods in proximity to schools. And we have increased asthma rates, and Representative Clark has mapped a lot of this. So I think there's a whole range of important issues that relate to this, and if we can get this into the Environmental Policy Committee, I think we could have a really great discussion about the impact of air toxins on our kids and our schools. So, you know, I agree with the gist of it, but it just simply doesn't go far enough, and I think needs to be vetted a little more, because I think you're on the right track, but there's a lot more we can be doing on this than just limiting it to landfills.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Detmer, I appreciate your passion. I do agree with Representative Hornstein that I think this is a larger discussion, schools being next to facilities or sites that may pose some dangers, and I think that's a larger discussion. So, members, I would ask that you oppose and vote no on this roll call.
Okay, and we have Representative Woodard and then Holberg, and then we're going to vote.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be kind of brief here. I too would like to see you, Representative Detmer, take this to the to Representative Dill's or Chair Dill's committee to take a stronger look at this. You know, as we're talking here, you know, Belle Plaine has a school that they're building the CapEx 2020 line right next to, and certainly that's a concern as well. I would prefer this to be a different conversation. I know that, you know, in Ways and Means, it's difficult to put a policy provision in. and we're debating a policy that probably very few of us really fully understand and its full implications. I would ask that you hold off and you take Chair Dill up on his offer as well. So I'm in the fortunate position of agreeing with Representative Mariani and even Representative Hornstein, for gosh sakes, I'm agreeing with him.
Where's that calendar?
We do try to honor when a committee chair does make a request to hear an issue and has made a commitment to do that. I think that's part of the issue here as well as how broad the amendment should probably be with other issues that have been mentioned.
Mr. Chair. We've heard from different people here in the committee, and if I can get a commitment to the people in the committee, it looks like I don't have the votes for it to pass, and I don't want to put people in that position. But I think my thoughts, if we got this in the statute, then we could add some of these other things that Representative Hornstein had brought up. We could add and amend the legislation that would be passed. And we don't even know if it would have gotten out of the conference committee either. But I hope that people here in the committee, and as we go forward next session, that we really take this up and think seriously about our schools. We talk about safe environments for our schools, but how much do we really know about the soils and the things that are next to our schools? And so, Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my request for a roll call. Thank you.
Or a roll call of the amendments. There's.
I'll withdraw the amendment, yeah.
By the way, I was tempted. I know that you were with the seriousness of the discussion, but when you mentioned teaching for 34 years, I was tempted to say you were a short timer. But having open school just slightly longer than that, 35 years.
The old timer.
With that, we have another amendment. This one is the 0489 or the A13. Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move the A13 amendment.
The motion is before us, and Representative Ansel can explain the amendment.
Well, hopefully, Mr. Chair and members, this is a much more modest and non-controversial policy measure. I'm serious about that. What this amendment does is, in a very straightforward manner, on page 58 of the bill, under Article 3, Section 1, that would be deleted. And this amendment pertains to the start of the school year, the Labor Day issue that many of you have voted on in the past. This amendment comes to me from a whole host of diverse businesses, everything from the Great Minnesota Get Together, the Minnesota State Fair, to resorts in my area, resorts in the Wilmer area, resorts in the Brainerd area. The tourism and hospitality sectors of our greater Minnesota economy. It is supported by a collection of minnow dealers and bait stores and hospitality venues and bars and restaurants. And two more comments, and I'm sure there will be a couple of questions. But if you look at the weather outside, you can easily discern that this is going to be a really, really difficult and challenging outdoor tourism and recreation season for many, many, many Minnesota businesses. To further exacerbate those challenges caused by weather, starting the school year in advance of the last major weekend holiday would further cause payroll problems, profit problems. The margins are thin in these businesses, and that would pose further difficulties. Speaking for the northern third of the state, we are dependent on timber, taconite, and tourism. And if any one of those three sectors of our economy goes into a downturn, either by market forces or, frankly, policies or things that we do here, it sends major shockwaves throughout our institutions, including our public schools. And our public schools in the Taconite Assistance Area have lost one half of their student enrollment since 1985. Without jobs, without paychecks, families can't form and people can't stay in northern Minnesota. And I don't know that you really want us all coming to live next to you. So for economic reasons, this is a pro-business amendment. I'm a little disappointed that the Minnesota Chamber and the Minnesota Business Partnership are rather neutral, but I ask for your support.
Okay, the motion is before us, and we have,
Mr. Chair,
my guess, several people that have indicated they want to comment. Do you want to comment now or wait?
I think I'll get in now, and then I'll just sit back. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have voted both ways on this amendment. As the Education Committee Chair, I'll be voting no on this. But after Representative Van Zelk said that if we don't pass this, he could move near us. Members, please vote your conscience. That's all I have to say.
Okay. We'll start with, we got a pretty good list here going, but the members can be brief because, like I say, we got one more bill after this, and the House would like to convene as soon as we're done. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. Issues like this bring together strange friends and partners, and I want to echo what Representative Ann Zelk said here today. I'm really concerned about the impact that this will have on our business community, especially explore tourism in the state of Minnesota. We've had many conversations about that in the Commerce Committee as well as the Tax Committee, so I support and applaud your efforts with this amendment. I will be supporting it. Another nugget to think about, too, is the Minnesota State Fair, the great state get-together. And I love the State Fair, and I was fortunate enough to have parents take me every single year, and we were able to do that because school didn't start during that time. But under this legislation as written, as you all know, State Fair starts about a week and a half before Labor Day weekend, and that would put the kibosh on that. And I don't want to take away from that great experience that we all get together and celebrate food and the egg community and everything else that our state has to offer. So thank you for putting this forward.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and members, and to my good friend, Representative Van Sels.
Who you don't want to meet.
No, who I don't. No. I'll come visit you, though, absolutely. members, obviously this provision has been around here for many years. And quite frankly, from my opinion, if we're going to be serious about education, we need to be serious about education. And I think that for our state to be one of only three states in the union, it seems to think that other things, even though they're important, are more important than the advice that our educators are giving us in terms of this issue. is beyond me. The as I said, we're one of the few states that takes this issue away from our local school districts, from our local elected school board members, to make education decisions that make sense for their students and make sense for their communities. And we're replacing that with St. Paul's wisdom that that we're going to bar kids being in classrooms, say on September 4th, when on those years when Labor Day happens to fall on September 7th. I don't think we can answer all the concerns that we have.
Is there a noise problem?
I don't think we can answer all the concerns of every...
I think we're getting some audience feedback here, so if the audience could quiet down and pay attention to what Representative Mariani has to say. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we can answer all the concerns of the hospitality industry with our education policy, nor do I think that we should. The fact is that every major education group and every major stakeholder involved in education policy year in and year out consistently come forward and support getting rid of this anachronistic, law that we have in the state. Minnesota Rural Education Association, the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Business Partnership has come forward in support of getting rid of this provision. I think we need to let educators make these decisions, members. The committee, our policy committee and the subsequent finance committee voted, quite frankly, in a bipartisan way to insert the provision that we have here, which, by the way, carves out the Thursday and Friday before Labor Day, allowing for that long weekend period, Representative Anderson, for family members to be able to avail themselves of the state fair. But again, members, 47 other states don't have this. 47 other states have the similar types of industries that Representative Anselms is properly concerned with. There's nothing in the language before us that says that thou shalt start before Labor Day. We leave it to local control, the locally elected officials, to make that decision. And presumably they're going to make those decisions in close communication with their local resorts, with their local hospitality industry, even perhaps with the state fair interests. Every year, school districts across the state have to jump through a bunch of hurdles in order to obtain waivers to our bar, to us barring them having their kids in classrooms early. We have waivers that say if you have a construction project of a substantive size, then you can be granted a waiver. And every year, school districts keep coming forward to the Department of Ed, sort of trying to stretch that waiver. So clearly, the desire and the pressure on the part of our educators is to be able to provide these kind of opportunities for our school children. And again, members, I would urge you to let our local elected folks and our educators make this decision and not make a one-size-fits-all here that clearly a number of school districts across the state and educators all across the state think is past time for us to undo this ban. So, Representative Anselms, we're still buddies, but bad amendment.
Okay, we have Representative Davids next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And 1991 was my first year in this body, and this was a hot issue back then. And it still seems to be today, and it kind of reminds me of a story which I won't tell in committee, maybe for the floor, about kind of reminds me of Sunday liquor sales in a way. This one just won't die. And with that being said, I just want to make sure that the author of the amendment knows that he has the full support of the far southeastern corner of Minnesota.
Thank you. Okay, we now have Representative Nornes. He'll represent the northwestern corner.
I do, Mr. Chair and members. Number one, I say this is a very
serious issue. There's a lot of laughter around here, but it's a very serious issue, particularly if you're in that business. We've got over 1,000 lakes that just exist in Otter Tail County alone. We have much, I don't know the exact number, but we have fewer resorts than we used to have, and they're disappearing every year. Why we aren't concerned about that? We're not losing school, but we are losing business. And when that's your livelihood. I just had a couple in my office this past year from up in my area that I believe they're in the second year. They have risked everything they have to own a resort. And here the legislature is taking away a couple of their weeks of business potentially because of what we're doing here today. So I think we have to be serious about it. I would like this to go away completely, permanently, so we can get on with other things. But to me, it's important that we have as long a summer as we can for these people. They can't do anything to change the season. We can do something about changing when we begin school. And one thing I'd like to point out is that this among this group is sort of a fun thing to talk about. But I have to tell you, I met an educator from southern Minnesota a couple of years ago at a campground. And we started talking, and I told him I was a legislator. He said, I'm an educator. We are so mad at the resorts in northern Minnesota because they keep insisting on this that we're not going to go up there and do business. All of us educators in southern Minnesota are going to boycott the resorts of northern Minnesota. Now that is awful that they'd even consider doing that. So it gets to be more than just a simple issue. It actually becomes down to, you know, us against them. And I think that's wrong. So I would urge a yes vote today so we can go to the state fair. Farmers can, last year they were farming until October. We don't talk about that. But some of this is so people have some young people that can help in the fall. That's a minor consideration today, but it's still important. So I urge a yes vote, and let's move on.
Representative Norris, you and I both know there's a lot of educators. I suspect that was a person probably speaking for himself, but thinking that the world is in agreement with him. Sometimes
I got the, Mr. Chair, I got the feeling he was speaking on behalf of many others we had contact with. I won't mention the school district, but I took it serious.
What did we talk about, boycott?
I took it serious.
Okay. I would suspect I spent a lot of time in a teacher's lounge, and I know there's a variety of opinions on that. If there were 10 teachers, they sometimes had 10 opinions, and Representative Denver is shaking his head, yes. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anzels, for bringing this forward. I have been waiting for a long time for a piece of legislation from your side of the aisle that I love and is not goofy. And this is it. I'm all in. Representative Anderson talked about the fair. I brought my kids to the fair. This is the first time they could go up the giant slide by themselves. You know, so I got to stand at the bottom and wait for them to come down. Asked every kid grabbing a gunny sack if he wanted to be in school before or after. Not one in my unscientific poll, not one child responded that they wanted that early start. Not one. So they're with you, Representative Anzel. So am I. You talk about timber, taconite, and tourism for northern Minnesota, but you got to talk about tradition. It's anachronistic or tourism, tomato, tomato, tradition. I say you got a good idea. Let's go.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Yes, well, with all these comments, I feel I have to comment on some of them. First of all, Representative Mariani, I bet our educational achievement in this state is higher than each one of those 47 states, so we must be doing something right. Second of all, to Representative Dean, I hope you asked all of those kids picking up a gunny sack what they thought about gay marriages and listen to them on that one. And then finally, I just actually, Representative Dean kind of made, we've heard it for the business and we've heard it for the tourism. I just want to speak for the kids. As a kid, I never started school before Labor Day, and I turned out okay. And I think that at least as far as educational attainment is concerned. And so I strongly support the NZELC amendment. And I'd like to point out, since we've already finished the higher ed bill, that the University of Minnesota doesn't start until after Labor Day. And if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for the kids of the state.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anzel, I've been very fortunate this year to have a young man from overseas spending the school year with me. And one of the comments early on was he came late into the year for a variety of reasons, and he was very, very worried that he would be starting school 2 or 3 weeks late. He got here September 1st. And he comes from a country where the temperature in August is well over 100 degrees. And not all of their schools have air conditioning. And he was equally as surprised when he saw the end date for the year, which is about a week and a half to 2 weeks prior. This young man is taking a couple of IB courses. And it's the classes, what's so amazing is he literally does not have to study for his IB classes. And there's a couple other classes he's having difficulty with, but they pertain to the English language. We are in a global race, members. We are in a global race around this world. And the schools and the systems and the nations and the states and nations that educate their kids better will win. And if we continue to shorten our school year, well, I won't say we'll lose, but it just makes it that much harder. I'll be voting against this particular amendment.
Okay, Representative Holder.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that maybe we're done with comments. We've spent over an hour now on two strictly policy amendments that have nothing to do with the fiscal components of the bill, which very easily could have been debated on the House floor. So you can add grandmothers across the state of Minnesota to your list, and I'm ready to vote.
Which what?
And they would like us to get the bills in the best possible form. The other instructions that this chair has before the floor debate, because that just lengthens things, but be that as it may, Representative Reinert, you're the last one on the list, and then we'll vote.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a grandmother, but I'm not on the list. I don't support. What I would say about this bill is currently in this legislation, the provision for the Labor Day start is not a mandate. Current law is a mandate. And this amendment is supporting continuing a mandate on our schools that hundreds and hundreds of our educators have begged for more than two decades for us to allow them to have local control. Many of us continually speak to local control. Why can't we let our communities, it's not just our educators, our communities would be involved in this decision. They would own the school start date. And I know Representative Dean talked about the kids who you asked if they'd like to start school because they're at the state fair. Well, I would say if you ask those same kids, if they were on their skis in January jumping down the hill, if they wanted to be in school, they'd say the same thing. So I don't think that's a great sample for making this decision. One of the things that nobody has talked about is there is educational data that supports narrowing the time between the end and start of school. We may, I think Representative Norna said, you know, we aren't losing educators or we aren't losing schools, but we are losing students. And we're losing students because the longer that gap is, the more time we spend in the fall in remediation. We already spend the first 6 weeks of the school year getting our students back to where they were at the end of the school year. And some of those students never get back. Yeah. And if we can shorten that gap, we know that there'll be less time spent on remediation, more direct instruction, and it will benefit our kids. And we may be, Minnesota may be doing well in student achievement overall, but our achievement gap is among the highest in the nation. And this bill would continue to exacerbate the achievement gap.
Mr. Chair, can I just comment?
I named him, I'm sorry.
Can I follow up to what
you said?
I just have a question of Representative Breiner. What have snow days done to achievement this winter? I mean, there have been a lot of days the kids have not been in school. Any statistics prove that we've lost the benefit of anything?
No, Mr. Chair, obviously school districts have policies about makeup for snow days, but snow days are short periods of time. The issue with the summer break is it's a long period of time, and despite the fact that Representative Kahn mentioned that the U of M starts later in the year, I hope those students' brains are more fully developed. What we know about brain development is that time span makes a difference for those younger students. So it's the length of the time.
Okay, Representative Ansel, you can make a concluding comment if you'd like, and then we'll vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I really appreciate the goodwill and the conversation and the seriousness with which you've discussed this issue. And just to conclude this, I just ask you to place a high value on these businesses and the taxes that they will or perhaps will not pay, and the workers who they will employ who will pay taxes, perhaps, in the context of paying for the revenue to support the spending in this great K-12 bill. So please vote for my amendment.
Okay, with that, we'll go to a vote then, and all those in favor of the A-13 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye!
All those opposed?
No!
No! Well, that was good direction for the chair. I think this is going to require a division. All those in favor signify by raising your hand.
Oh, those ears are 73 years old. We should.
I just want to win one. I just want to win that.
There's 34 members of the committee, so 19 indicated support, so that's rather obvious that it might be motion carries.
Thank you.
With that, we have Representative Gabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the H630A50-3 amendment to be before the committee, and the good news is this one actually has fiscal impact. Yeah. Members, Representative Marquardt has been carrying in his bill the governor's recommended language on the School Climate Council and the Safe Schools, in the School Climate Center. Both of these elements are also in the Safe School bills, House File 826. It's next on this committee's agenda. We have been working the language on those two entities in my bill. I'm simply asking to move that language that has been vetted through the committee process into this bill. They do have costs. They are the payment for those two entities is covered in House File 630 that Representative Marquardt has. There are two small changes to the language that's worked its way through the committee process. On page 1, lines 24 and 25, related to the School Climate Council, at the request of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, we add a charter school representative to the council. And on page 3, lines 17 and 18, we give permission for the School Climate Center staff to talk to the School Safety Center staff, who were included and envisioned in Representative Paymar's omnibus bill that came through this committee last week, if I remember correctly. With that, I'd ask for your support.
Okay, so Representative Dabney moves the a 50-3 amendment. Any discussion? Representative Damar.
Just a typo on line 3.18. That safety should be capitalized.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to incorporate a capital S into my amendment. On page 3, line 18, the word safety should be capitalized.
That seems pretty major.
Everybody have that? That's incorporated. Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? Representative Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing this forward. Representative Dabney's bill has been a work in progress, was heard before the Finance Committee, and I do think this is the updated version and does match better with the governor's school safety center that or Representative Paymars and the other bill. So I would ask members to approve of this amendment.
Okay, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two quick questions here. On 2.8 to 2.20, which is the qualitative and quantitative data gathering, what exactly does that entail? Will there be personal data about students being collected by the School Climate Center?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
No.
And then secondarily, Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, so what would happen if the bullying bill that you're carrying does not pass? What would happen with the School Climate Center?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I think a fuller answer to your question, Representative Woodard, it would be related to the order of passage or defeat. If the House File 826 doesn't make it to the governor's desk, then we'd have a question about whether House File 630 had made it to the governor's desk and created these two entities. So I don't know that I can answer your question yet. I'll let you know about May 21st.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 No.
No. Motion carried. That's all the amendments that I have. So Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 630, Burst and Grossman, be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Dabney, the school safety bill is the final one on our agenda today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 630 to be before the committee, recommended to pass and sent to the register.
Okay, that motion is before us. And Representative Dabney, I know that you and I have talked. You have a couple of amendments that, or an amendment, that puts the bill in the order that you would like it. So, Representative Dabney, do you want to move the amendment?
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move the H826DE3-1 amendments. Last evening, or just around 8 o'clock, the House File 826DE3 amendment was posted for the public. After that, nonpartisan staff went through and found some edits, largely technical in nature, that they've incorporated into the DE3-1 amendment, catching some internal inconsistencies in the bill in the use of language, changing some plurals to singulars, that sort of thing. I can go through each of those if you would like.
No, I think the amendment, you mean all the technical?
Correct.
No, I don't know if that's necessary. That was, there wasn't anything substantive between the two amendments. So we did talk to Representative Holberg, and she thought it was better that we incorporate, as I did as well, those technical changes into the DE3 amendment, so that that would be a little easier for people to follow. Representative Abel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to understand,
DE3-1.
Are there changes between the 826 as it's whatever the fourth engrossment and the DE3-1 besides technical?
Mr. Chair, staff was just highlighting one substantive issue that I will put before the chair as to whether to keep into the DE3-1 or remove its. I will leave that to the chair's discretion. This is the DE3, which is why you're not. You got the DE3-1?
Right here.
What page are you looking at? Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I believe the only change between the DE3 and the DE3-1 that would be considered substantive is on page 4, line 12, the insertion of the words based on a person's actual or perceived, and that goes over onto page to line 13.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, I just was kind of, I didn't give you a chance to do what you're probably going to do, but you know, you said to put in the shape the author wants it. This would be the fifth hearing that the bill has had, and so in my opinion, you can't just put the bill in the shape you want it without telling people what changes there are in the base, delete all, from whatever 3 or 4 or whatever. And so, because it was voted on at a different committee under a different language. So I'm just curious what changes there are from the...
Abler was asked if he would go, if he needed to go through. We had two different versions of the DE3 amendment, and he asked if he needed to identify all the technical changes, but he's going to be dealing with the substance of the amendment.
Yeah.
Just, they were mainly, as I understand it, I didn't speak directly to Ms. Larson, but what we were talking about, the difference between the two, with the exception of what was just identified, or mainly grammatical, is that correct, Ms. Larson? He's nodding yes.
Grammatical, some consistency within the bill so that language is the same in multiple places, things like that.
So the intent is not to avoid going through the amendment. It was just the grammatical. Referencing the grammatical.
I misunderstood, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
So, Representative Dabney, if you then would like to... Representative Woodard. Question.
Thank you. Just a quick clarifying question, Mr. Chair. So the House Research Bill Summary is reflecting DE3-1?
No. Ms. Larson, Ms. Larson, technically we should not just be shaking our heads, so I just take a
seat there.
She shook her head.
It's probably best that it's hard to pick that up on the tape.
Mr. Chairman, members, Lisa Larson, House Research. Representative Abler, no, I'm sorry. I simply ran out of time.
Chairman.
Oh, Woodard.
Which one?
No, we're not.
Evers got more here.
So, but that's why the author is going to walk through the bill. I mean,
yes.
Just the intent. Now, it's my understanding that the summary, though, by and large, it doesn't track this, but pretty well tracks what's in the bill in the end here. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That with the exception, I think, of the language described earlier about real or perceived, actual or perceived, excuse me, the other changes between the DE3 and the DE1 are changing some plurals into singulars, aligning language. There were points in the bill as it's gone through where we referred to student and other times where we referred to as individual. This uses student throughout where that's appropriate. Things like that are not substantive policy changes, but are clarifying and consistency sort of language.
So if you read the summary, you'll get the gist of the bill, but it won't track the order of the bill necessarily. Your Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 826 and the DE3-1 amendment before you is the product of Governor Dayton's Task Force on the Prevention of School Bullying that met last summer. Currently, as you know, Minnesota has the lowest ranked anti-bullying policy in the country, with the exception of the state of Montana, which has no anti-bullying policy whatsoever. It's an attempt also to move Minnesota to the front of the pack, a leadership position in the emerging area of education reform, which is school climate. Looking at what is the experience of students in school in terms of their relationships with each other, relationships with staff, and staff's relationship with each other, and how that sets or does not set a climate conducive to learning. And if folks wish, I can go into a little bit more of the national movement on that. The DE3-1 amendment is a further polishing, limiting, and targeting of the earlier versions of the bill. Senator Ortman had addressed the letter to the Attorney General's office with concerns about constitutionality of some of the provisions. Many of the changes in the DE3 are a reflection of the work of the Attorney General's office on better targeting the language to fit within existing constitutional case law. Members who sat on Representative Mariani's Education Policy Committee know that, for instance, we included the word materially in terms of what is the impact of bullying on a student's educational experience. It has to be materially disruptive. We believe that that met the constitutional test. The Attorney General's office reviewed the Tinker decision, which many members familiar with education law may recognize, and found that actually the language in the Supreme Court decision is materially and substantially. The DE3 then reflects that. The major, I think, substantive policy change in the DE3 that also is a reflection then on the fiscal impact of the bill is the removal of private schools from being under the House File 826. They are allowed voluntarily to report their anti-bullying policy and report incidents if they so choose, but it's entirely voluntary. I can certainly go on.
No, I think if you're done,
I can be done.
We'll just open it to questions then, Representative Dabney. Any discussion, Representative Woodard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so on the constitutional, we had a lot of discussion on this in the constitutional argument on the non-public schools. So what's the ruling there? I mean, I get the ruling that you want to take out, and I certainly support that. But I'm just a little bit interested in how that discussion went. I mean, how is it unconstitutional?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I'm not sure that it, you know, where's Representative Barrett and his baseball umpire analogies? I don't think I would have described the constitutional questions as high and outside. It was a judgment call that the using the receipt of public dollars or services as the basis for what I still think is a compelling state interest in making sure that all students are safe was a little softer than we were looking for. At one point, as you know, earlier in the bill, we offered a grant program that private schools could access to facilitate their funding of anti-bullying efforts. They're certainly needed in private schools, just as they are in both traditional public and charters. But then we read the state constitution, which, as you know, prohibits the funding of sectarian schools. So my understanding then is that we could not provide them with a straight grant to a sectarian school to fund their anti-bullying efforts, because that would be a violation of the state constitution. And at that point, we decided that discretion being the better part of valor. We have ongoing concerns about the safety of students in private schools, but we do also have support from private schools. The Minnesota Association of Independent Schools, MACE, is in support of the bill and has stated a interest and intent in complying. Many of those that association schools already have strong anti-bullying policies and practices that are very similar to, I won't assert identical with, but very similar to what's envisioned here in this bill.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so how is, that's a good segue into, how is this different than what has been described by many of our school districts of already occurring? I think even in testimony at one point, you when somebody threw out a large number of what it would cost to actually implement this, you had mentioned, well, don't you already have people who are doing this now? So did you kind of walk through that? Well, how is it different than the policies that are in place already in our school districts looking at this issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Woodard. I think there's a number of important elements to this to your answer to your question. Number one, this sets a level playing field across the state. There are districts that are doing good work on anti-bullying policies. I look at my own children, 10 years old and 12 years old, in a K-8 school, so they're both in the same school. I track what that school is doing in Minneapolis. They seem to be doing very good work on anti-bullying. We know that's not the case across the state. We know that we get reports from students, we get reports from parents, we get reports from teachers and administrators that they're struggling with having robust policies and the tools that they need to prevent school bullying and to respond to school bullying when they see it. We also know any number of schools are implementing, for instance, the Olveus program, the Hazelden Foundation, that's strongly supportive of the bill, came down. They are the United States purveyor of the Olveus anti-bullying curriculum. And here they talked of, I believe, 60 school districts across the state that are already implementing that curriculum. Many schools are implementing the PBIS, the Positive Behavioral Intervention Strategies, which are similar in nature in terms of setting broad school-wide climate structures in place to prevent negative behaviors and work on supporting and building positive behaviors. So we're going from inconsistency to one robust state policy and providing parents, teachers, and students the tools that they need to create stronger school climates for all of our students.
So, Mr. Chair, and this kind of goes to the ways and means issue here of the cost, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, today the Minnesota Department of Education has a model harassment and violence prohibition policy. There, you know, it's voluntary for school districts to take advantage of that, and I would assume that to your comments that for the most part our school districts care very much about the school climates that, you know, are operating in their schools. Is this basically just taking what is in existence today, the model harassment and violence prohibition policy, and mandating it, or is it going above and beyond that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I think what we're doing is establishing a comprehensive policy here in House File 826, and then we have a state model policy developed by the School Climate Council, which has a number of members from across the state and different interest groups with different perspectives on school climate. Have them develop that. Then we leave it up to school districts to decide whether to adopt the state model policy, or to, within parameters, develop their own. If they choose to develop their own, we encourage parent involvement, in fact, direct parent involvement and community involvement, to make sure that there's a broad base of buy-in and interest in building stronger school climates.
Well, Mr. Chair, then, so if there's just, and Representative Dabney, if there's you know, just a few schools that aren't doing this, you know, the gap, because you already have the model policy, and I think we both agree that most schools have an adopted policy today. It obviously goes above and beyond that when MMB looks at a $51 million biennium cost to our schools, a local impact to our schools. Would you agree it's $51 million? Is MMB right about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I think there are some significant procedural and substantive problems with the draft local impact note that MMB provided. So, no, I would not agree.
Okay. And what do you have an idea what the cost is? Sorry, Mr. Chair. So do you have an idea what the cost is in your mind?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I don't have a calculator along today, no.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dettner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gavney, how many school districts, from what I understand, is that all districts already have a policy. It's the department requires it, and I know my district, you know, we went through the policy and the bullying and also the harassment policy. And is there just a problem in just a few schools, or do we have to have a state mandate policy? And can school districts come up with their own definitions for bullying and harassment and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dettmer,
The governor's task force on the prevention of school bullying toured the state and did listening sessions. And I think what you would find if you had sat in on those, hearing from students and parents in particular, the challenge of school bullying is not isolated to a few schools in the state. It's in many schools across the state. But I think we need to shift our focus just slightly. And what this is about is building stronger school climates, safe and supportive school climates for all students so that they can better achieve in those settings. In House File 826, for instance, we focus on remedial responses to incidents of bullying. We know schools know how to suspend students. That's easy. It's also counterproductive to student achievement and high school graduation, and the data and research shows that. So by shifting to building strong school climates for all students, whether you're going to school in Representative Anzell's district after Labor Day or mine before Labor Day, or anywhere else in the state, we enhance opportunities for all students and student achievement by building stronger school climates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think everybody understands after my amendment today that I'm all for a good school climate. I guess, there are concerns regarding the mandate and the cost, and I guess I'll just close with that. Thank you.
Okay, what I'd like to do, and then I'm going to recognize Representative Loon, but to get the bill in the order, I think we're ready for that, and then we'll have further discussion. But Representative Dabney, I don't think you had yet moved the amendment, so.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the HA 26 DE3-1 amendment to be before the committee.
That motion is before us, and any further discussion on the amendment, and then we'll have discussion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I missed it, but did he go through what changes were between the DE?
Yes, he did.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. Now the bill is technically then up to the way the, even though we've been talking about the bill, the way the author would like it. Representative Loon is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dabney, just more of a overall question. I know you've been working on this issue for a long time, and you carried legislation in 2009-2010 session. Can you highlight what differences there are in that legislation and the one we're considering today?
Representative
Dabney. Representative Loon, you asked tough questions. Clearly, the Climate Center and the Climate Council were not part of the 2009 legislation. I think similarities are the robust state policy and the local adoption. I think in this you will find much more of an emphasis on climate, school climate, that this is not simply looking at a kid and saying, don't do that, that this is about how can we build safe school climates for all kids for achievement, also as a prevention strategy. So I think there is a significant shift in emphasis here, also the emphasis in House File 826 this year on remedial responses. I don't believe that was in the 2009 legislation, but frankly it's been a while since I've looked at that 2009 legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney. Just one other question. Not being on education, I haven't had a chance to focus on this till it's immediate with some things that happens in the legislature. But I was meeting with some of my principals recently, and one of them shared with me that, any incident that may occur, unkind words between a couple of kids on the playground may trigger a call from a parent that the child is being bullied. And one principal said to me, that's not bullying, that's a behavior issue that happened. Bullying, in his opinion, was something that's more sustained over time, and there's a period of conduct. And I was just wondering if that would be consistent with how bullying is described or defined in the legislation, and kind of how schools are going to be able to draw the line between those kinds of things. Because obviously, behavior issues are addressed in schools every day in Minnesota, but
how we distinguish between, you know, that and bullying. And I thought he raised a good point. That wasn't something that I had contemplated before.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, thank you, sir. I think the conversation you had is useful. The addition of the words materially and substantially does significantly differentiate I don't like your haircut, which is, you know, a behavioral issue, from an incident of bullying. And so by adding, we added materially at the first committee hearing today, after review with the Attorney General's office, substantially, so that we clearly are complying with the Tinker establishment, the Tinker language. It differentiates for teachers and administrators. What do we need to deal with as a bullying issue? And what does the teacher need to pull Jim aside and say, you know, you need to work on being nicer to Jennifer?
Okay, Representative Holgers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, can you tell us what components or elements of the local impact note you disagree with and their methodology, or maybe expound on that a little bit?
Thank you. Yes, Representative Holberg, I can. First of all, it was a pretty small survey of school districts. It was heavily weighted to rural school districts, and obviously there's validity, and you got to talk to the rural folks, but you also should talk to the urban and metro folks, and it looked like MMB fell a little short of that. Secondly, I haven't seen the survey, so I don't know what the questions were. And it's hard to evaluate the validity of an instrument if you don't first of the results of an instrument if you first don't get to look at what the instrument was in itself. Largely, the concern I have is it doesn't differentiate new expenses that might come with House File 826 and existing expenses that school districts are already incurring. So, for instance, the largest single cost is the annual cost of to designate staff in each building to have primary responsibility over bullying, receive formal complaints, and oversee responses and consequences. Well, they've already got that. You might, depending on the school building, you might call that the principal, the assistant principal, the dean, the counselor, the social worker. Somebody in the building is dealing with behavior issues. None of us are sending our children to a building where there isn't someone dealing with behavior issues. That's not a new requirement in House File 826. They attribute a cost to other items such as requiring adults to intervene when bullying is seen, investigate reports, that sort of thing. Well, again, that's somewhere between an expectation and a requirement already. That's not a new cost attributable to House File 826, although reporting summary data to the state would be. Hitting send on an email. So there's a number of pieces like that. Down at the last item on page two of the local fiscal or local impact note, adopt internet policies to prevent bullying. We already require cyberbullying policies. So again, I'm unclear why we attribute what of that is new costs and what of that are costs that are already incumbent on the school districts.
All right, and if I might, the amendment that was adopted, the DE3-1, I believe, what, if any, change would that have to the fiscal note that was written to the 2E, second engrossment, that's in our packet?
Mr. Chair, I believe the DE3-1 removes private schools. I believe, depending on which version of the previous versions of the bill, there was a grant program that would have gone out to private schools. That is no longer in the DE3-1. The lack of private schools having to submit materials and report would decrease the burden on the school climate center staff at MDE. Also, the DE3-1 amendment brought the bill in line with what we thought we'd done previously, and I think even testified to, which was remove the language requiring the Department of Education to review
school district policies. School districts still have to submit the policy, but it's no longer under the review required review of the department. That should decrease the number of FTEs. Mr. Chair, what I had intended to do after amending House File 630, the omnibus bill we just heard, was to remove the school climate center and climate folks from this bill because that language is being carried in House File 630. I don't know if you're open to an amendment to delete sections 12 and 13 of this bill at this time or not.
To strike those sections.
That's correct.
To reflect, I think that would be fine.
At which point those are the fiscal impact on the state in House File 826 are contained within the Climate Council and Climate Center. Obviously, by removing those, that would decrease the fiscal note on this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, given the fact that we don't do fiscal notes on omnibus bills, I would suggest that we not do that and re-up the amended version for a fiscal note so we actually know what the fiscal cost is for the amended language and make sure that that lines up. And then you can make, you know, certainly to have it moving in two places doesn't hurt, but if you delete the language in this bill that has the fiscal component absent a fiscal note on what's in the omnibus bill, you're really not going to know what the changes did to the fiscal impact to the state.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, this is my first year on Ways and Means. I'll defer to your counsel on this, or Mr. Marks's counsel on this.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, I think there are two ways to do it. You could leave it in this bill and we could ask for a fiscal note on the new version of 826, or we could ask for a fiscal note simply on those two sections of the Omnibus Education Finance Bill, and we would get the same information either way. So.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Holbert,
we've kind of had this conversation before, and it happens that, you know, we put things into bills and move them separate, but the ability for the public to track what's going on and follow an issue is always much easier when that language is carried on an individual bill rather than being put into an omnibus bill. So my preference, and for clarity and ease of access, if we leave it so that the general public, superintendents, etc., can access the most recent fiscal note to get the whole picture of what the policy is, I just think works a little more easily for those not in the know, if you will.
As Mr. Marks pointed out, it can be tracked one of two ways. If that raises your comfort level, that Representative Holbert, that's fine with me. Representative Dabney seemed to be open to either version, so is it okay to proceed with the bill as is then and get the fiscal note?
That's just fine, Mr. Chair. I was trying to simplify things, I'll stop that
point. Yeah. Representative Obergita, because I got a couple more.
Mr. Chair, I am done in that I don't think that there will be major impacts to this fiscal note from the testimony, but I think it's important that we know that for sure before the K-12 bill hits the floor.
Okay. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, I haven't had the pleasure of sitting through one of the, I believe, five committee stops that this bill's been through, but having survived junior high myself and raised four children to adulthood and now working on grandkids, I'm reading this bill and thinking, wondering, what is it we're actually trying to do here? I represent two school districts who actually are full of people who actually care about the climate. By climate, I think you mean the learning environment and the social environment in the school. And it appears we're setting up an entire bureaucracy here to spend a boatload of money that everybody in the state is going to have to report to or comport to. And I'm wondering just what are we trying to change? Who are we setting this up for, the adults or the kids? I guess that'd be my first question, and maybe another question might follow. But is this for the adults, or is this actually for the kids?
Mr. Chair, this is for the kids. This is about creating safe school climates for all students. You may have seen law enforcement personnel in the East Metro, led by the Ramsey County Attorney, Mr. Choi, had a symposium seminar day on bullying, because they look at the increased incidence of criminal activity amongst bullies. We know that then that it has an impact on the bullies that's negative for the for those individuals. It's also negative on the public purse, because these folks are more likely to end up arrested, jail time, prison time, that sort of thing. Additionally, we know from research that it can have lifelong impact on the targets of the bullying, and so ameliorating that sets us up better both for those students, because this is about those students, as well as, again, the public purse and achievement.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the clarification, because it was as I had feared. You have to understand that the bullying is not actually coming from the teachers or the administrators or school board members. They're the folks, at least in my district, actually care that children find themselves in a safe and unthreatening environment. You're agreeing with me, I believe, that the people actually doing the bullying, harassing, intimidating are other students. And those are the folks that we're kind of aiming this at. So at some point, some adult somewhere is going to have to harass or intimidate a student who's a bad actor. And Mr. Chairman, I think that's been the way it's been since I was a kid and since the beginning of time. And so I think what you're setting yourself up for here is a major disappointment. We're going to create a 20-some million dollar a year bureaucracy here that is attempting to change the behavior of kids, which I'd submit teachers and parents have been trying to do since there have been teachers and parents. And I'm wondering what evidence you have that this bureaucracy is actually going to make kids be better than they would if we'd, say, mandated Sunday school, or mandated that they sit at dinner with their parents every night, or other things that actually impact the behavior of kids and actually make them, compel them, or train them to be nice people. This is a big reach, folks, and I'm can color me skeptical. I mean, I appreciate the motive. But at the end of the day, having survived high school and college and junior high myself, and raised my own kids through it, and now dealing with my grandkids through it, I think that we're setting ourselves up for a major disappointment when 10 years down the road we're dismantling a bureaucracy and we still have kids being mean to kids. It's just going to happen.
Well, Mr. Chair, nationally, states are looking more and more at school climate. The federal government established what they refer to as the S3 grant project, Safe Supportive Schools, and President Obama has recommended more work in that area after the Newtown massacre. 11 states across the country, including our neighbor Wisconsin and Iowa, have received grants to look at issues of school climate, suspension, and those things as a way of increasing achievement. Representative Beard, you survived high school. I'm glad of it. Not everybody does. And I don't think we can afford that. And I think efforts to help more students do better, survive high school, achieve, be part of that 21st century workforce, is a worthwhile investment on the part of the state, not only to make kids act better, as you say, but to create climates where they can achieve and doesn't run into the constitutional challenges of mandating Sunday school.
Okay, we'll recognize Representative Abler, and then at that point I'd like to vote if it's all right with the committee. Representative Abler.
More than all right.
I'm just still like mandating Sunday school.
It was his idea.
Okay, I should have listened to his comment better. I think, okay, it just kind of took me a little off guard. I want to thank you for one thing, Representative Dabney, about taking the private schools out. I think if you got counsel from the Attorney General, whoever, I missed that part. I was out in the hallway. That was good counsel. I tried last year, was it last year or the year before, to have a version brought forward by Lori Swanson, which I thought was a really good one. And through no fault of yours, especially, it didn't move, and I think that would have been a better way to go about it, probably less expensive and able to be focused. And we had some conversations, and you were very gracious to me to explain a few things, and I appreciate that. Can you tell me again, this is a concern I have about the whole thing that I thought the other version addressed better. And by taking the private schools out, you took a whole bunch of concerns of mine away. Because people go there because of issues of faith and things they believe. And obviously, you believe we have different beliefs about hair, you and I. So you mentioned haircuts coming in. I thought, well, boy, I missed that one. And actually, but if I'm raised to believe that people with long hair are just better people and God loves us better, and I, obviously it's not true. He loves you too. But and if I would tell somebody that who had different kinds of hair, yeah, this is not going the way I hope it's fair.
Yeah, but if you keep it up, I might get Representative Woodard's vote.
But I'm just going to pick a silly example that has nothing to do with anything people truly believe. But if I, a person would be, could be offended by my views on hair if they had chosen a different hair religion that they were in. And I'm not being mean about it. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I say, I just don't think you're right. I think God doesn't love people with the kind of hair you have. And if you persist in having this kind of hair, bad things are going to happen to you. And so what happens to that kid? I know such a kid in Anoka District a decade ago. And it wasn't about hair, and it was about expressing her faith. And she was bullied by the teacher on the other side. Mm-hmm. And that's just as... So, but it seems like these bills are all for people who have... are on the other side of the discussion. So what happens to a person who has a belief in something that they're sincere about? They're not trying to say anything bad to the person. They don't mean any harm. They're just saying what they believe to be true. And they're willing to test eternal judgment about it because they believe it so strongly. What happens to that kid? And is there some protection that they can stand in their faith of whatever it is? We're a pluralistic country. If you're a Muslim and you believe that if you... I don't know what their beliefs are, but if you don't do what they do, if they don't wash their feet and do all those things, then you're not going to be honored later, whatever they think. And if you're, you know, a Catholic and didn't go to get communion that week, and you believe that, and you really believe it, what happens to that kid? And so are they going to be in trouble, and are they going to find themselves sanctioned some way by this language?
Mr. Chair, I've phoned a friend to get you to the specific language, Representative Abler, but I've got a couple of responses for you. In education, the issue around behavior is time, place, and manner. So to continue with the faith concern that you have, you know, as long as there are math tests, there will be prayer in schools. If you receive the test and you look at it and you figure, you know, the only way you're passing this puppy is the direct intervention of God, and you bow your head quietly and pray, that's not an issue. If you decide that the only way anybody in the class is going to pass is through the direct intervention of God, and you stand up and disrupt the quiet of the testing classroom and attempt to lead the class in a prayer, the issue isn't your faith. The issue is you're disrupting the classroom. So there's protections there for people of all faiths, because as you say, we live in a diverse society. Our schools are actually more diverse than our broader society because of some of the demographic trends out there. So the issue isn't what do you believe, what do I believe, it's time, place, and manner. And are you being respectful while holding to your faith? You can have a debate on a topic that includes issues of faith within a classroom. I was a social studies teacher. Chair was a social studies teacher. You know, there are respectful boundaries while you explore the differences. And we all come out better when we understand different points of view on the same issue. The language in the bill, and Ms. Larson can help us here. Thank you, ma'am. Yes. On page 4, lines 11 and 12, is very clear that while we talk about numerous classes of students, including explicitly protecting religion, it is not limited to just those classes. This sets a standard that we want safe and supportive schools for all students. Nobody's left on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, and I'm sensitive to have a policy discussion in the Finance Committee, but this hasn't come in front of me, and it's really been on my mind. And so I just have one last question, then I'll be done.
And I think we'll vote.
And I respect that. I know it's been a long day. I wanted to vote for a bullying bill. I wanted to vote for the one last year. I don't know if I can get to this one, and you know I'm sincere in that. So you help me on the floor today to see if there's some way we can just, you can assure me that it's clear, and if we need to, if there might be a sentence to clarify what you said that may not be clear in here that would be at least productive toward what you intend or what you don't intend, because you don't want to be the guy that helps set up the dialogue that I made mythical discussion about, you know, expressing my belief about hair gets me in this whole mix of, which is not at all the intended. The focus becomes on that, and you lose the benefit of what you do want to accomplish, which is a high value. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Well, I thought you were suggesting that the bill only protects one side of the debate, and I don't, you know, I've never understood that both sides of the debate are protected.
Mr. Chair, the bill explicitly does not limit anyone's First Amendment rights. So when you're talking about debates, when you're talking about faith, when you're talking about those elements protected by the First Amendment as interpreted by the Supreme Court and how they apply to students, because this does only apply to students, it protects everybody.
Okay, with that, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 826, Orth and Grossman, be recommended to pass as amended and placed in the general orders. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And tomorrow morning we meet the approximate, well, we're going to announce it at 10:30 or the call of the chair. It'll be a day similar to today's. So watch your emails if we don't meet at 10:30. With that, and we're going to have taxes and transportation tomorrow. It'll be a full agenda. Meeting adjourned.